All right.
Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight, feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you Christmas contraband and ancient tales.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. And I'm glad to be back. I've been sick for a few days, took a few days off. Feeling better, back to be here. I'm happy to be here back in the studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. Coming up on the show, it is Thursday, and every other Thursday, Dan Feinberg joins us. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. We talk every couple of weeks about TV, and that'll be coming up in just a couple of minutes. Also, we are going to be we're going to be talking about some of the best political movies of all time, considering that we just had an election, some weird election stories as well. We're going to talk about some embarrassing TV and movie roles that actors have, which ones are the ones that they hate, which ones are the ones that they are very not excited that they've done. So there's plenty of other things that we're going to be talking about this morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. Also, famous movie Easter eggs that you can look for and find what's hidden in these movies, little treats that are hidden in the movies. So that's coming up as well. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. And those are the ways to get a hold of us. You can also download our podcasts. Every second of every show is podcast. And you can download and subscribe for free. You can go to iTunes where you get your podcasts. Subscribe free. They automatically get sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. And glad to be back. And let's say hello to my producer. This morning is Ben Anderson. Hi, Ben.
What's going on, buddy? Good to see you back here in the studio.
Thank you. Not 100% quite yet, but better than I have been the past couple of days. So, and I'm glad to be here. I hate missing work.
Me too.
So now you're going. You're going out of town.
Yeah.
You're going to New York.
That is correct.
And tell everybody why.
I'm going to be out there for the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System Conference and Golden Microphone Awards. So I have a student that is a national finalist for best play-by-play sports broadcast in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, pretty awesome. Eric Willowit, the kid's he's really good.
Wow, that's cool.
Some good stuff from him in the future.
All right, well, very cool.
Yeah. And,
so, and you leave tomorrow?
Leaving tomorrow.
For New York.
Correct.
All right. And Ashley will be filling in for you. I've never worked with Ashley before. This should be fun.
Ashley, she's a good time. She's a fun girl.
Okay, cool. All right, she'll be producing the show tomorrow, Friday morning, with all of our regular Friday features, too, all set up. All right. Let's go into the newsroom, and it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, sir.
How are you?
Doing well.
Good.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's good to have you back, man.
Thanks, man.
The 60% or whatever percentage we've got of you, it's good to have you back.
Yeah, and we normally start at 1.
A little early.
We're half an hour early this morning because we're following a late Hawks game, an exciting late Hawks game. So we'll have the Express to play back later this morning, too. But Of course it ends. 16 seconds left. Kaner knocks one in. I mean, what? I mean, how else is that? I mean, how else dramatically could it end? And why? And of course, it's going to be Kaner. I mean, it's just crazy, man. Absolutely crazy. So we'll have that coming up as well. So, all right. Let's see. We've got Dan Feinberg coming up, and in a couple of minutes, and he is a TV critic for the Hollywood Reporter. And I've just been I've spent most of the last 3 nights in bed. Just laying in bed and not feeling well at all. So hopefully, you know, this whole thing will shake and I'll be 100%. So all right, that's gonna be fun. Did anybody watch the Oscars? Did you watch the Oscars, Ben?
No, I was here working. Mm-hmm. So I caught the recaps afterwards.
We're gonna talk with Dan Feinberg about, you know, because he did a review of the actual broadcast itself, so we'll talk about what he thought of it. Vic, did you see any of the Oscars?
I did not. I was sleeping, getting ready to come in, so yeah, we didn't.
Okay, well, it was, you know, it was something. I mean, I thought it was, you know, interesting. We'll get into this when Dan is on. But I thought it was kind of interesting that they did in fact go without a host, and it didn't seem to matter that much. Of course, some of the winners were a little disappointing. A lot of people were disappointed that I happen to be a fan of Green Book, and so I don't know if I would have picked it for Best Picture, but I actually like that movie despite all the controversy around it and everything. And I know a lot of people can't stand that movie, and they were very disappointed by the fact that it won Best Picture. So we'll get into all of that. I thought some of the presenters were really good. I thought, as we'll talk about when we get Dan in here, I thought the Olivia Colman's speech was great. I was surprised she won. I mean, I really thought it was going to go to Glenn Close.
Yeah.
I thought it was, you know, it was like her time. She'd never won an Academy Award before. Yeah, but I thought that was one of the biggest surprises of the night was Olivia Colman, and her speech was fantastic.
It was amazing.
It was so funny, and she's just great, and she's outstanding anyway. But overall, I thought the show was okay. You know, it wasn't anything special. A lot of the winners were predictable. Like I said, Olivia Colman was the only sort of surprise. Everything else just kind of checked out. The way it was supposed to go. You know, Rami Malek won for Best Actor, of course. Supporting Actor went to Mahershala Ali. Supporting Actress went to Regina King. No surprises there. You know, Director went to Caron. Foreign Film went to Roma. Yeah, and then I guess, you know, the Green Book was the movie that snuck in there. It was the dark horse of the winners. I thought Roma was going to win Best Picture, but when it won Best Foreign Film, I was like, it's not going to win both. You know, there's no way Roma's going to win Foreign Film and Best Picture.
Oh, yeah.
And so when it won Foreign Film, I was like, well, it's not going to win Best Picture. But yeah, I thought some of it was pretty interesting, some of the presenters that they brought out and the people who introduced the Best Picture clips, which we covered the Friday before the awards. Independent Spirit Awards were fun, as usual. Those were a good time.
Don't spoil it for me. I DVR'd it.
You DVR'd the Independent Spirit Awards?
But I haven't gotten to watch it yet.
Okay. All right. I will say this. Aubrey Plaza did a great job.
Cool.
Yeah. She did a really excellent job. And I that's always a fun award show anyway, because it's so laid back, and they, you know, it's presented in a tent, you know, on the beach. Mm-hmm. Nobody's really, really dressed up. They try to make it sort of the opposite of the Oscars, so it's not so pompous. It's more relaxed. And it's always a lot of fun. And, of course, it's, you know, it's uncensored, so, you know, anybody can say anything that they want and not get in trouble. So it was awards over the weekend. And then sick for the first three days of the week. Just like confined to my bed, and not feeling well at all. So, but I'm getting better. I'm on the mend, and I should be better in the next couple of days. So just in time for the weekend.
At first, I just thought you were, you know, celebrating really hard that Bohemian Rhapsody didn't win.
Yeah. That's what a lot of people were probably thinking. Yeah, that's probably what it was. Yeah. So, anyway, the Oscars were, they were, you know, as like I said, nothing really outstanding except for Olivia Colman. Everything else was pretty much predicted. And it was, you know, it wasn't, I didn't think the show ran too long. Normally, I guess it ran, this is true, I guess it ran 31 minutes less than last year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I think last year it ran like 4 hours, so it's still not as impressive as you might think. So, anyway, all right, interesting award-filled weekend, and now back to work here, a little late, sick for a few days, but I'm back. And speaking of back, Dan Feinberg is with us every couple of weeks. He joins us. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print. That's F-I-E-N. And right after this break, we will have Dan on to talk TV right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday, coming up a little bit later on. And we've got a bunch of really cool topics that we're going to get to, including, you know, since Tuesday was Election Day, we're going to talk about election movies and political films, and a lot more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. But it is the second Tuesday. It's 2 weeks ago, and I'm sorry, Thursday. I don't even know what day it is. Thursday, and Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us every other Thursday. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print. Lots of TV stuff to talk about, as usual, with Dan. And let's get Mr. Feinberg on. Dan, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm okay. I'm all right. I was getting over a little bug here. There you go. So,
are you on the other side now? Or
I am just on the other side. I was just, but it knocked me out pretty good for a few days, I got to tell you. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And lots of stuff to talk about. And let's talk about you did a review of the Academy Awards broadcast. What did you think in general?
I thought that given all of the chaos and bad press that surrounded the Oscars for the better part of 3 months, probably the expectation of disaster led to what actually aired on Sunday night looking far better than I might have feared it was going to look. Is that a qualified enough positive review? I think it could have been horrible. I was bracing for it to be horrible. I expected it to be horrible, and it was absolutely not horrible except for several of the wins. Uh-huh. But that's a different story.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I mean, I watched it too, and as I do, all, you know, every year. And I thought I'm like you. I didn't expect it to be all that great, but it wasn't nearly as bad as, you know, like you just said. All this time, since Kevin Hart left, and then they were going to go hostless and all this other stuff. But it was better than I thought it was going to be.
And I think now everyone's going to have to try to figure out what the lessons are that they were supposed to learn from it. And I don't know that anyone's actually going to learn any correct lessons. And I don't know what the correct lesson even ends up being, because one of the most interesting or significant things is that everyone was anticipating, regardless of how the show was, that the ratings were going to be utterly in the tank, and instead they were better than last year. And I don't think anyone could have anticipated that. And because Hollywood never learns the right lessons, people are going to take from that, oh, well, clearly we don't need a host because the host doesn't matter to ratings. And I don't know that that's really true. I suspect that the ratings really and truly were tied to the fact that people knew that Black Panther, A Star Is Born, and Bohemian Rhapsody, three genuine blockbusters, were up for Best Picture and were expected to win a number of things during the night. And I think that was a much bigger factor than anything involving the host or lack of a host. Did you miss a host?
No, I didn't really. There were certain presenters who came out and killed and were quite good, but it didn't really stay away from me. I don't quite understand why Queen and Adam Lambert performed to open the show. I mean, I get obviously because Bohemian Rhapsody was up for all those awards and everything, but I found that distracting. But I mean, I'm in a particularly bad mood with Brian May and Roger Taylor at this point, anyway, because of what they allowed to be, what the story that they allowed to be told about their bandmate, which is just, you know, a work of fiction for the most part. But yeah,
I am with you there, and also I do not think that Bohemian Rhapsody is a very good movie. I understand, though, kind of the functional purpose it served. As I said in my review, the purpose it served was an in-the-room purpose. It was to make sure that people in the room got a jolt of adrenaline, and also, again, to make sure that the millions of people who aren't us, who loved Bohemian Rhapsody, and, you know, I'm right there with you, but there are people who feel differently, and I think they were brought in by it. So I understand it. I didn't think it was A, very good, or B, necessary, but I see the functional purpose it served. Also, gave them something to promote, and that's the thing more than anything that a host provides, is it provides, you know, someone you can put in a poster, someone you can put in a commercial, and they didn't have that.
Right.
So instead they went with, okay, everyone tune in and watch Adam Lambert and Queen, and then we'll figure out what the rest of the show is from there, but they needed a hook, and it served that purpose. Also, apparently in late April, they're doing a two-hour documentary thing on ABC about the band moving on after Freddie Mercury and with Adam Lambert. And so, basically, I assume there was a quid pro quo that went on with ABC, and ABC agreed to do this embarrassing commercial special in April if Queen and Adam Lambert agreed to perform, and everybody will be happy with that, I guess, except probably for you. Me either.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, overall, I thought, you know, I thought it was good. There were certain, I thought Olivia Colman's speech was the funniest of the night, and unexpected, obviously. I didn't expect her to, I really didn't expect her to win. That was one of the big, genuine surprises. And I really loved her. I loved her in The Favorite. And I thought, you know, she's just charming and really funny, and everybody expect. I mean, I totally expected Glenn Close to win. That was a genuine shocker for me.
I think I expected Glenn Close to win, but I think if you'd asked me who the number two choice was, it would have been Olivia Colman, because she'd been kind of the other person who had been picking up wins in the lead-up season. You know, she did win the Golden Globe in comedy. She won a BAFTA award, et cetera. So those aren't necessarily entirely predictive, but they're kind of things that made her the outlier choice. And so I was definitely surprised, because I figured, you know, it was going to be a coronation for Glenn Close, and who was going to have a problem with that? But, you know, instead it didn't happen. And Olivia Colman is magnificent, and he is magnificent in The Favorite, and I can't wait to see her in The Crown, and she is always great in everything, honestly. So good for her, and good for her getting this recognition, because I feel like probably American audiences, as a rule, barely knew who she was 4 months ago, whereas British TV audiences have been watching her for 25 years. So, but I'm okay with her getting recognition. I'm down with that.
What were some of your? You said that there were awards. I mean, you said the show went better than you thought it would, except for some of the awards. What were some of the awards that you were not pleased about?
Oh, I am not a fan of Green Book. I genuinely detest Green Book for many of the reasons that many people have articulated frequently. And I thought the way that, you know, the sort of vapid nature of all the acceptance speeches for it also kind of confirmed how intellectually bankrupt that movie is. So the fact that kept winning for things and kept winning for important things. I mean, you know, best picture, best screenplay. Come on. There is no way that is a best screenplay. Oscar winner, Mahershala Ali, I can accept because he is really great in that movie. But yeah, so that one annoyed me. All the Bohemian Rhapsody wins, particularly the little wins. Like, you know, Rami Malek was going to win anyway. That, you know, what are you going to say? People liked his teeth. but for that movie to have won for sound mixing and sound editing just goes to show that the main body of the Academy shouldn't be voting in those two categories because they do not know what those awards recognize. And if the Oscar voters don't know what those awards recognize, then they're just going to give it to loud movies, and that's what they did. And so the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody beat Roma, which is a stunning soundscape, it is a tapestry, and it beat First Man, which is an astounding technical achievement in terms of its sound and also its effect.
Yep.
Yeah, that to me was such a huge embarrassment and just showed how ignorant a subset of the Oscar voters are. So those were the kind of things that got on my nerves.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. I can totally understand that. And I just, in it, like you said, Bohemian Rhapsody was just loud. I saw it in the, when I saw Bohemian Rhapsody, I saw it in IMAX. And so it was particularly louder when in the theater that I saw it in. But I was astonished by the technical aspects of First Man. I actually thought First Man was a terrific movie that got sadly overlooked during the awards season, and I know it bombed at the box office. That doesn't help, but man, the you know, that was really beautiful. And Roma, I mean, what's my favorite film of the year? And and that's also just a beautiful film. And I agree with you. Bohemian Rhapsody doesn't even come close to those two films.
Yeah, so those things kind of got on my nerves, but there were plenty of awards that were wonderfully satisfying also. So, it came and went. There were lots of good speeches. There were lots of significant firsts, and those are always important things. I thought the speeches for all of the shorts that won were all fantastic and a great argument for why you should never even consider taking the shorts out of the live part of the show, because they want it more. It means more to those people. Why would you take away this moment, or why would you give them the impression that they were less than? It was such a tone-deaf thing they thought about doing, and the speeches were all so good. So yeah. I hope they don't consider that again.
All right, well, there, we took care of that. We got a lot more TV to talk about. Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure thing.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at TheFineprint, F-I-E-N. And we'll take a break here, and when we come back, we've got more TV to talk about with Dan Feinberg. All right, right after this. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday will be coming up a little bit later on. We're actually going to talk about embarrassing TV and movie roles for actors and some really cool Easter eggs that you can find in movies that are hidden, plus a whole lot more political movies and election films and things like that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. My guest right now is Dan Feinberg. He joins us every other Thursday to talk TV. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And let's welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Whiskey Cavalier. You did a review of that. I have not watched it. What did you think?
Whiskey Cavalier, the true purpose behind the Oscars, which turned out to be an elaborate promotional campaign for Whiskey Cavalier. And if you aren't already sick of promotion for Whiskey Cavalier, good on you. I'm kind of baffled by what ABC has decided to do with that show, the aggressive over-promoting and confusing scheduling of it, because it premiered on Sunday after the Oscars at a confusing time that may have varied depending on your market. And then the episode that premiered on Sunday aired again on Wednesday, but probably would have been treated by your DVR as a repeat. So it's all very confusing, and it's a little bit too bad because it's a fun show. It's not a great show, but it's the kind of thing that TV used to do a lot of back in the 80s. It's from the heart-to-heart, moonlighting, Scarecrow and Mrs. King. It's from that vein of romantic action dramedies where really the purpose was to watch two pretty people bicker and flirt and either try to stay in love or fall in love. And the two stars here are Scott Foley from Felicity and Felicity and also Felicity. people may know him also from Scandal and Scrubs and whatnot, but let's be real. Felicity stars Scott Foley, and Lauren Cohan, who, of course, was on Walking Dead until last season, when she just kind of vanished on Walking Dead, not all that ceremoniously, but at least if Whiskey Cavalier fails, they can just bring her back. It's not like she was eaten or anything. And yes, one of them is a CIA agent who feels too much, and the other one is an FBI agent who doesn't believe in personal relationships, or maybe it's the CIA agent who doesn't believe in personal relationships and the FBI agent who feels too much. Anyway, doesn't matter. They're from two different government entities, and they find themselves working towards a common goal with the help of a ragtag team and a lot of technology and a lot of beautiful settings. The show was produced largely in Prague, but also around other parts of Europe, and it looks very pretty, and the banter between the main characters is sometimes charming. They have very good chemistry. I think that Scott Foley is charming, if you happen to like Scott Foley. If you don't, this isn't going to be some sort of new Scott Foley. It's Scott Foley. I think Lauren Cohan is great. I think she's every bit his equal, and that's why it's annoying that his character's name is Whiskey Cavalier. She doesn't even get her name in the title. It's a little bit confusing. His name is Will Chase, so WC, Whiskey Cavalier, in case you can't figure it out. And it's not a great show. It's got some cringeworthy banter that I thought was kind of dumb. The plot lines are all completely by the books. But if all you're looking for is pretty people flirting, wearing pretty costumes in pretty European settings that are very nicely photographed, it looks very authentically shot in Europe, which sometimes you don't get, it serves that purpose. And it really is just a light, fun piece of TV, and maybe there's not enough of that on broadcast TV. So it's definitely not bad. It's not perfect. It could become a real hoot, but only if people watch it.
Is anybody watching it?
Barely anyone watched the sampling, but, you know, who knows what that means, because it wasn't really airing in prime time anywhere, so it was kind of a guesswork thing when it comes to ratings, and it aired at a different time in every market. In some markets, it was airing at like 1 o'clock in the morning. On the Los Angeles market, where I am, the Oscars ended at like 8:20 Pacific, and then viewers had to sit through nearly an hour and 40 minutes of random red carpet post-game, just people being interviewed about the Oscars, and then finally they aired it at 10 o'clock, so who the heck was going to sit there and watch all of the post-game red carpet talk? So I don't think that's going to say anything, and I don't think tonight's audience is going to say anything, because people are going to be like, wait, I already saw this, or I didn't already see this, but it looks like I already saw it. So I don't know, but it really is the kind of show that I feel like could be a crowd pleaser, and so it's funny that ABC has decided to alienate the crowd by being so over the top, and it's love and adulation for the show.
Mm.
You know, it's a weird decision. I understand that this is the biggest promotional platform they have, and they wanted to give Whiskey Cavalier the biggest potential sampling of eyeballs they possibly could. That being said, they probably convinced a fair number of viewers that this was not a show that they wanted to watch by being as aggressive and kind of needy as they were. So we'll see if it blows up in their faces. That would be a little bit too bad, because really this is the kind of show that in the 80s would have run for seven seasons and would have been a fairly large, solid hit for ABC. And I guess we're not in the 80s anymore, are we?
No, we're not. All right. So that's Whiskey Cavalier. Now, another show that I'm has piqued my interest is on Fox. That's Proven Innocent. Tell us about that.
I don't think that one needs to pique your interest too much. It is a fairly regulation legal drama that has a number of really good stars in it, which is probably why it might have piqued your interest.
Right.
The cast features, among other people, a frequent TV star who hasn't really had a hit show, and therefore people keep trying to make her a star, Rochelle Lefevre. She plays an attorney who spent time in jail in her teens and 20s after being presumably wrongfully accused of murdering her best friend. The prosecutor who accused her is played by a sneering, evil, wicked Kelsey Grammer. Once again, playing a Chicago politician, though not like Boss, not nearly as good as Boss. And the cast also includes Vincent Kartheiser from Mad Men, who hasn't really gotten that many good opportunities since then, and the great Russell Hornsby, who is always fantastic in things. And it's the latest in a long string of legal procedurals that try to do the kind of innocence project thing, where they're like, oh, wrongfully accused, we're going to get someone out of jail after 12 years behind bars by using DNA or something. And it's just not very creative. And then there's the subplot thrown on top of it where we're supposed to wonder, did Rochelle Lefevre really kill her friend? Did her brother really kill her friend? Is this a mystery we're supposed to be solving? And I have no answer. I've seen a couple episodes, Fox sent episodes out of order to critics, which is always frustrating.
Yeah.
They sent the first and fourth episode. and while I'm a smart enough person to figure out what probably happened in the intro, it's not a very good way to handle things. And also, if they send out a fourth episode, they must think it's a better episode, and it wasn't. So I have very little reason for enthusiasm on that one. It's basically, if you are a fan of one of the actors in it, and I really like, I've liked Rochelle Lefevre for years, going back to Life on a Stick on Fox, classic sitcom. But, Russell Hornsby is always great. Vincent Kartheiser is in his own show entirely. He's playing a private investigator for this law firm, and he's weird and quirky and doing nutty, kicky Vincent Kartheiser things, and I kind of want to watch the show about him, but it's not that. So I temper your enthusiasm at the most.
Okay. All right. I shall do that. All right. So I do want to mention really quickly that True Detective Season 3 has ended. And you mentioned it as a great, great showcase for Mahershala Ali, correct?
Indeed. Have you started on that one, or are you still holding off?
No, I started. I haven't watched. I'm about three episodes in, so I have started. But he's just, he's just great.
He's great, and Stephen Dorff is great. I feel like there's been a sort of groundswell of people wanting to single out Stephen Dorff, and I feel like that is based on kind of an underappreciation for how charismatic and good an actor Stephen Dorff was in the early phases of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really was a good actor who simply made a lot of bad choices or had a lot of bad choices foisted on him by the industry. He's definitely good. I just don't know that I necessarily was like, ooh, that's Stephen Dorff, as I've never seen him before. I thought Stephen Dorff was a good actor. And to me, basically, without Stephen Dorff, the show still works. Without Mahershala Ali, there's no show. And so that's why I'm going to continue to single out Mahershala Ali. But if people love Stephen Dorff, got no problems with that. He's very good as well.
Okay. All right. Hang on, Dan. Okay. We got to take a break.
Sure.
Dan Feinberg is with us, and we're talking TV, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. More TV talk after the news, which is next. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday will be coming up a little bit later on. Right now, though, Dan Feinberg is my guest, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. He joins us every 2 weeks to talk TV, and there's a lot of TV to talk about all the time. So let's bring Dan back. Dan, welcome back.
Thank you, Nick.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Flack. Now, this is on Pop, correct?
It is indeed on Pop, which some people will know as that network that Schitt's Creek is on when it's not on Netflix.
Right.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else that people will know it from. Did they have Big Brother After Dark for a season?
Oh, they always have him, but they still have Big Brother After Dark.
Okay, still do. Okay, excellent. So then in that case, you totally know where, you know exactly where Pop is.
I know exactly where
Pop is. On your preset.
Exactly. It's a, by the way, for my cable company, Xfinity, it's Channel 4. That's how I know.
Wow, that is really high and prominent. That's it's somewhere in the upper 90s or 100s for me, and I really don't know where it is. Fortunately, though, I've seen all six episodes, so I don't need to seek it out, and I don't have the time for Big Brother After Dark. So, yes, Black stars Anna Paquin, who has sort of made, I don't want to call it a descent in her career from top-lining an HBO show to being on a WGN show that probably people didn't know existed to being on a Flack drama, not Flack drama, Pop drama, called Flack.
Right.
But, yes, she plays a publicist in London. She is not, however, a British publicist. Somewhat confusingly, she's pretending that her character is from Philadelphia, but there's some sort of elaborate story wherein her father was South African or something, so it allows her to have whatever accent she wants. So that's always that's always good free play, because while she does an okay American accent when she's calm, cool, and collected, when she gets emotional, her native accent comes out, and her character has to spend a lot of time being emotional, because she is one of those TV characters whose professional life is all together, and she spends her life putting out other people's fires and fixing other people's messes, but in her personal life, and try not to be too shocked by this, she's a mess.
Uh-oh.
And if that is the kind of thing that shocks you, then Pop's Flack may be for you. If, however, you've seen that sort of storyline probably a million times, I specifically refer to it as a vocational irony narrative, where she helps everyone else with their problems but can't help her own, then very little of note that you're going to be surprised by. I think there are some interesting things in the general backdrop. I think it's a perfectly fine thing to be a TV show. It just, basically, her firm works with a bunch of celebrities, and so every week her solution to the various celebrity problems is to throw together an elaborate farce. And so she's constantly being like, ooh, let's distract from this by making a sham wedding. Let's distract from this by doing a sham sex tape. And you don't really come away with any real idea of what it is that a crisis management rep does, how whatever she's doing makes her different from a publicist, because she's not exactly a publicist, or honestly, necessarily why you would care about any of it. It's not an awful show, and it probably is more complicated and nuanced than a lot of what Pop's general programming has attempted to be. And I think if people are fans of Anna Paquin, it definitely has that going for it. And some of the supporting performances are good. Sophie Okonedo plays her boss. She is always good, but wildly underused. Genevieve Angelson is an actress who's been in need of a good starring role for a long time. Lots of people maybe know her from Good Girls Revolt on Amazon or from Fox's Backstrom. She's just a really good actress who, for whatever reason, is having a hard time finding the defining role, and she plays Anna Paquin's sister, and she's really good. There are sometimes some decent guest stars. Bradley Whitford is in either the fourth or fifth episode playing a obnoxious, formerly famous actor who's now in the twilight of his fame and career, and he's very good. You know, give it an episode or two if you're interested in the world and the situation. It might be amusing. It's not a great show. It has some elements to it, I would say.
Okay. All right. Now, who's creatively behind it?
He's a playwright. We're playwright / British TV writer named Oliver Lansley. All of the episodes were directed by Peter Capaneo, who's director of The Full Monty, so he's got more experience with comedy. I would not exactly call it a comedy, though. The show is kind of a dark comedy, but not exactly, in so far as I can't imagine anyone is going to laugh at anything in it. But in this day and age, comedies don't need to make you laugh. So it definitely fulfills the not making you laugh qualifier.
Okay. All right. So that's Flack. Has that premiered already?
Yes. I believe it premiered last week at some point. So we're probably into the second episode this week.
Okay. Have you seen any of the Jordan Peele Twilight Zones?
I have not. They are keeping that one, I don't want to say tightly under wrap, because we are still, you know, we're still a month out from it, so I don't want to make it sound as if they're being wildly secretive with it, but they have not yet begun to disseminate episodes. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. I have some concerns, just because it's a tough brand to get right, but I'm hopeful.
Okay. All right. You know, you talk about, last time you were on, you talked about Lorena, speaking of Jordan Peele. And you wrote a piece about that and Leaving Neverland. Talk a little bit about that and Leaving Neverland.
And surviving R. Kelly, because it's been an early 2019 with an awful lot of really difficult to watch TV documentaries about sexual abuse, basically. And in the case of those three, my article in The Hollywood Reporter kind of ties together a kind of 90s nostalgia with Me Too outrage. And that's what these three things do. They basically all point to unresolved history, basically, that R. Kelly has never or had never spent any time in jail for his various alleged misdeeds. Now he's at least spent a weekend in jail, so that's something. Michael Jackson was acquitted in his one trial that actually went to verdict. The Lorena Bobbitt, John Wayne Bobbitt situation reached a sort of ironic conclusion wherein he was acquitted of sexual abuse against her, and she was acquitted by virtue of irrational response or whatever qualified insanity they wanted to plea. And so that was kind of a weird version of justice. But these are these three documentary series that ask you to spend hours being confronted by your memories and reevaluating your memories. So with Lorena, it's confronting you for your laughter. It's confronting you for all of the giggling Bobbitt jokes. Not necessarily that you made, but that one made, that people made.
Yeah.
It's still a joke that people made. When Amazon announced at press tour a couple weeks ago that Lorena Bobbitt was going to be at their party that evening, a round of giggles went off, and the publicist made a joke about it. You know, the grow up is the easiest way to put it. I think if you watch Lorena for all of its 4 hours, you'll find it very hard to laugh at the situation.
Yeah.
And I think that is the thing it wants to make you do. And similarly, Leaving Neverland, which premieres this weekend, I believe, if you watch it, you will have a hard time feeling the same way. You will have a hard time denying. And I understand that there are Michael Jackson apologists out there who will still defend him, and that is what it is. But if people actually watch the 4 hours of the documentary, it's hard to watch, it's unpleasant to watch, and it's hard to come away feeling that these people aren't sincere. If people watched 6 hours of Surviving R. Kelly, same thing. And it's just very notable that these three documentaries have come out now, and what they're asking us to confront about our past, I find very fascinating, and I find the documentaries to be all important to watch, if unpleasant to watch.
Okay. Boy, the timing on that is kind of strange, isn't it?
In the case of Morena, it's obviously a 25th anniversary thing. These are the things that we celebrate the anniversaries of. With the case of R. Kelly, it's notable because I think that the point that Dream Hampton wanted to make, the director wanted to make, was this is something where justice can still be done if you believe that he did these things, and there's taped evidence, allegedly.
Yeah.
So justice hasn't been done. It could still be done. With the case of these two accusers of Michael Jackson, there's, people claim they're doing this for the money or whatever. I don't think there's any real advantage to either one of them in the things that they're saying. They're not really going to get a settlement from the Jackson estate. It's not happening.
Yeah.
And so all they're doing is they're telling their truth, if you believe them, which I came away having a hard time not doing. So, confrontation. These are all confrontational films. These are all unpleasant films to watch. And I understand why lots of people will feel like they don't need to sit down and watch them. But they're necessary in their own way, I think.
Okay. All right, Dan, hang on, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. And you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. A few more minutes with Dan coming up right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive on this Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday will be coming up, too. One artist, three songs. Get your request in now. All right. Let's get back to our conversation. Dan Feinberg joins us every 2 weeks. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And lots of TV to talk about when Dan is here, and we always welcome Dan back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Nick.
Hey, I noticed one of the tweets that you threw out there was about the extended 15-minute openings of The Daily Show, which I watch daily.
Fittingly.
And that was a little observation that you made. When did you start to notice that?
It's been a couple weeks, possibly even at this point, a couple months. But if you watch, it's been a gradual transition. There was a transition in format where he started doing the here we're rushing through a few headlines and then we're getting to a main headline,
right?
Which is a little bit kind of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver asked,
right.
Only they don't have the time to go into that. But they started doing that maybe even 6 months ago. But I'm guessing it has been since the Jordan Klepler show went off the air and there ceased to be anything that needed to be coming on the air at 11:30 that they just started sneaking into the 11:35, 11:36, 11:37 time.
Yeah.
And so basically, the first segment of that show has started being 15 to 16 minutes, which it really was not before. And I'm all for them trying to cover things in more depth, and I think it's interesting. And they've been experimenting with the format in other different ways. There, a couple nights ago, John Legend was there, and he did a musical performance and an interview. That's the kind of thing they've done a couple times. They've had a couple episodes with two interview guests.
Yeah.
And I theorized on Twitter that some of it has to do with, I think, the fact that they're a little shorthanded on correspondence. I don't know if it's really necessarily true, because when I start listing them, it seems like there are great correspondents there. I love Roy Wood, always love Roy Wood. Desi Leidick is great, though she's only on occasionally.
Yeah.
Dalton Sloan is good. I think Jabuki Young White is great. I think they got fantastic use out of him with the Jussie Smollett.
No question
story.
About it. No question about it. It was great. It was great.
Unreal. And they knew so quickly that they had
yeah.
this guy who could do that, and kudos to them. But like Ronnie Chang pops in every couple weeks at this point because he's doing other things. I think they're wildly overusing Michael Costa, just because I think he's at least prolific. But I don't understand what the rhythms are with the correspondence at this point, and I think that that has something to do with the fact that they simply lost a handful of them to other things. They lost Hasan Minhaj to Netflix.
Yeah.
They lost Michelle Wolf to Netflix. Jordan Klepler went off to do his own show that didn't work. Ronnie Chang went to do other things more frequently, so he couldn't be on weekly. And I think that it's caused them to reevaluate the structure, and I don't mind it at all. I'm fine with the experimentation. I like the format. It just happens to be something I've been noticing the past couple weeks and randomly felt like tweeting the other day.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I watch it. I watch it every night, and I happen to love. I really love Trevor Noah. And I noticed a little bit of tweaking that they've done at the very opening, because it used to be the show would open with him sitting at the desk, and now he gets a walk on, and you know, he gets to walk on to the set, and sometimes they do wacky bits behind the partition, and they never did that before, so they're loosening up that part too, because it always started. The Daily Show always started with the correspondent sitting with the host sitting at the desk.
Except for that Trevor started standing initially at Memory Serves, didn't he?
Did he?
I feel like when he initially began, there was a wave. They've tried a lot of things with Trevor, and I think if you go back, there have been four or five different versions of kind of the opening of the show. And I like this one. I like when he makes fun of the sound effects, and when he makes fun of the graphics.
A thing, and
the camera placements.
I mean, we
have both been in some sync on really liking the show he's been putting on, I would say, almost from the beginning. They're trying new things, and they're obviously finding lots of ways to get those extra segments he does just to the audience out there more frequently,
yeah,
and those are always fantastic.
Those are great. Yeah, those are absolutely great. You know, you mentioned John Oliver. Thank God he's back. That's all I can say. It's too long. I mean, what was he gone for, 3 months?
He was gone for a long time, and the problem is that we unfortunately live in a news cycle that is nonstop.
Yeah.
And so there is never a period at which anything becomes so slow that you don't get to the end of the week and go, okay, I look forward to what John Oliver is going to spin on this week's news.
Right.
There's no such thing as a downtime. And so, yes, he took too long. And how dare he take vacation time, for heaven's sakes. But yes, I've been very happy to have him back. I thought his Brexit thing a couple weeks ago was terrific.
Yep.
And I thought his savaging of psychics last week was appropriate and on point.
Yeah. It's just great. It's great. Okay, let's talk a little bit about tell us about Doom Patrol. This is a DC show?
Yes, it is the second DC Universe show, DC Universe being DC and Warner Brothers comic themed streaming service that has been slowly rolling out. They started with Titans. They started with a bunch of animated stuff and then added Titans as their first live action show, and then Doom Patrol is the second. And Titans it just annoyed me. It was trying way too hard to be grown up and adult, and it was all proud of its edginess and its violence and its swearing. And in contrast, Doom Patrol is proud of its kind of irreverence and quirkiness, which I found a good deal more appealing. It's basically a kind of off-kilter X-Men kind of thing, complete with Timothy Dalton as the mad genius who has a wheelchair and rounds up fledgling superheroes in his country mansion and kind of talks them through their psychological issues. The show stars Brendan Fraser, Matthew Bomer. They're both in kind of interesting roles where they play their characters in flashbacks, they play their characters' voices in the present, but Brendan Fraser's character is a robot man, and Brendan Fraser is not that. And Matt Bomer's character is kind of an Invisible Man style thing with bandages all over his face. So both, neither actor is in that guise. But yeah, it's funny. That's what it is. It's kind of sloppy and messy, and the plot line, which inevitably involves a bad guy trying to destroy their community or the world, I assume, eventually. It doesn't make much sense, but it's got a very good, very meta sense of humor, and a lot of the voice actors are very good. Brendan Fraser's doing just really great work entirely with his voice for the most part, and he gives this robot man a fair amount of sympathy, which is impressive. And yeah, it's not great, and we're also getting into this moment where we probably are nearing saturation on the revisionist adult superhero genre. Mm-hmm. Because this came out at roughly the same time as Netflix's Umbrella Academy, which I think is perhaps less fun, but about a million times better made. So one can decide which of those two things one wants to prioritize. Then come summer, Amazon has The Boys, which is executive produced by Seth Rogen, and it's also a, you know, superheroes in the real world, but they also swear and things are violent, and they have sex, and so I'm right on the verge of saturation with that, but I'm still currently amused by the genre, so talk to me again in a few weeks, and we'll see if I'm still abused.
All right. Okay. There's just a lot of comic book stuff, you know, on TV and in the movies, obviously. And it's just, I've reached, I think, some sort of a limit.
There has to be a limit, and I think that for a long time, basically, if you were a fan of the genre, you had to be a fan of everything. And so there was an absolutism.
Yeah.
And then we passed out of that, and it became you pretty much have to choose if you're a DC person or a Marvel person. And so then that became factional. At this point now, there's so much of everything that I think you have to start choosing even from within the DC and the Marvel. You can't simply be like, I'm going to watch every single one of the darn CW DC shows, because if you do that, that's 7 hours a week or 6 hours a week.
Yeah.
People have to have lives, and it's tough. And as someone who watches an awful lot of them, it's exhausting.
It is. I agree. All right. Dan, always a pleasure. And we will talk to you in a couple more weeks. You can read Dan Feinberg in The Hollywood Reporter, and you can follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Is there anything you're looking forward to?
Sleep. Maybe the last couple episodes of Top Chef, clearly, which we didn't even get to. But I am very excited about the home stretch of the Top Chef season.
That's
what I'm looking forward to at this exact moment. But also, better things premiered this week, and I've seen several episodes of that, but I'm looking forward to seeing more. I think we are picking back up with a lot of the good TV, because as you will remember from last year and the year before, everyone has decided now that April is where the good TV has to be for Emmy purposes. So get ready, because March has some good stuff in it, but everything's just going to go nuts in April.
Okay. All right, Dan, and you're going to keep up with it all, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, Dan. Thanks.
Feel better, Nick.
All right, buddy. Take care. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Follow him on Facebook and Twitter at The Fine Print. F-I-E-N is how you spell that. And he'll join us again in a couple of weeks. All right, let's take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs. Get your requests in. And Rasko wanted to hear some Cars. So that's what we're leading off with. By the way, Yeah, it's Triple Play Thursday, and so that's the Cars. That first Cars album, man. It's one of the greatest. We talked about this before. It's one of the greatest debut albums of all time. I mean, there's so many hits on that record. And I remember when that album came out, man. It was huge. It was huge. It was one of those albums that everybody had. You know, there's certain albums that that just everybody owned at the time. And everybody had that. Everybody had the Cars first album. So, all right. So, Triple Play Thursday, just... let's see. Peter in Decatur sent in a text. Welcome back, Nick, even though it's not at 100%. Take care. Thank you, Peter. 301 area code said, good morning, guys. Welcome back to Nick. Glad he's feeling better. Yes. Not 100%, but much better than the past couple of days. Much better. So, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You know, every actor and every actress has taken at least one role that they regret. Even A-listers, even award-winning actors and actresses, if you look back at their resume, there's at least one role where they went, oh, man. Whether it be on TV or whether it be in the movies. So Collider, this website Collider, put together a list of actors who have absolutely embarrassing roles that they hate and they regret. And some of these are pretty funny. So if you guys can think of good actors and good actresses who have been in terrible movies or had terrible roles, what would you say that it would be on that list? 312-981-7200. The intro here says, being a movie star seems easy. You make millions of dollars. You travel the world. You have crowds of adoring fans. But for celebrities, embarrassing TV or movie roles can make even A-listers regret their life choices. Whether it's a hit character that they can never escape from, an ill-advised sequel, or a comedy co-starring a dinosaur, these are the most regrettable movie and television roles that the stars still cringe about today. Now, this first one might be surprising for people. But Christopher Plummer as Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music. So, though this beloved musical starring Julie Andrews is considered a classic, Christopher Plummer deemed it one of the most regrettable movie roles. One of his most regrettable movie goes, playing the hard-nosed Captain Von Trapp who learns to love music again, Plummer found The Sound of Music script to be cheesy, to say the least, often calling it The Sound of Mucus. Plummer also said the musical script was so awful and sentimental and gooey, though he admitted recently that he doesn't completely hate the Rodgers and Hammerstein film. Don't expect to be belting out any of the old tunes in any specials. Yeah. So that surprises me because, you know, that's considered such a classic and a beloved movie. But Plummer didn't like it. So, all right, this is an obvious one right here. Ben Affleck. What movie role do you think he regrets?
Ben Affleck?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with being Buttman in Mallrats.
No.
No? You don't think so?
I don't think so.
Because he was great in Phantoms.
Yo. It's Daredevil.
Really?
Yeah.
I liked that one.
I hate Daredevil so much, said Ben Affleck in a 2016 interview about his former movie roles. The 2003 big-budget comic adaptation of the story of Matt Murdock, blind attorney by day, blind crime fighter by night, was a box office bomb. Ratings were poor from the critics, audiences, apparently the star himself. Affleck has said that the Daredevil was not the only truly regretting role. That means a lot from a star of Reindeer Games and Geely. Those are both terrible.
Yeah.
Daredevil didn't stop Affleck's affinity for superhero roles as he donned the cowl to play Batman in Batman vs. Superman. Though he's rumored to be trying to leave the DC universe, Affleck might soon add Batman to his list of regretful roles. Yeah, those DC movies suck. They're terrible. Speaking of Batman, how about George Clooney?
Yeah.
Batman and Robin is his choice.
I'd say Uma Thurman wasn't too bad in that one, but everybody else.
Oh, God, yeah. It was such a bad movie. And then you got Arnold Schwarzenegger just running around doing ice puns because he was Dr. Freeze or Mr. Freeze or whatever the hell he was. Ice to see you. Like that was, and I just remember there was at one point a hockey the villains you know that his henchmen just start playing hockey.
Yeah,
that's one of the only things I remember about the movie. I've only seen it the one time. George Clooney wasn't too thrilled with his turn as the Caped Crusader. The 1997 was it that long ago? The 1997 Batman and Robin was known for its cheesy lines, tacky visuals, and nippled suit. Those infamous bat nipples. That's right, they did add nipples to the... Both director Joel Schumacher and Clooney have apologized for Batman and Robin. Clooney joked that his role got him disinvited to Comic-Con for about 20 years, and that he's afraid his nipple suit has ruined the character forever. Fortunately, Christopher Nolan came along to reinvigorate the character, and Clooney became an Oscar winner, acclaimed director, and a tequila millionaire. So, yeah, that was just a really, I mean, that was just terrible. Terrible. Alec Guinness, Star Wars. He hated Star Wars. He hated it. Oscar winner with a 50-year-old career, Alec Guinness should be known for a range of legendary films. Instead, he's best known for sporting a lightsaber as Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars. While filming Star Wars, Guinness was unimpressed, calling the script, quote-unquote, mumbo-jumbo and bloody awful lines. After the film became a phenomenon, Guinness resented the fact that Star Wars defined his movie roles. Allegedly, a child once asked Guinness for an autograph, saying he'd seen Star Wars hundreds of times. Guinness said he'd sign the autograph, but the kid promised to never watch the movie again. Yeah, Alec Guinness was famously anti-Star Wars. You know, I mean, obviously it's a legendary role in a, you know, in a movie that has gone on to become a classic. But he hated it. He hated filming it. I remember reading stories about it. I mean, and he, you know, he wasn't shy about saying how much he hated Star Wars. I mean, this is Obi-Wan Kenobi we're talking about, and he, you know what I mean?
Do we need to change my DJ name?
No.
I mean, oh, man.
No, we can't change your DJ name.
Okay, I hope not, because I kind of liked it.
Yeah, no, of course. Doesn't just because Alec Guinness didn't like the part. You
okay.
But I, you know, and like I said, he was not shy about expressing his opinion about how bad he thought Star Wars was, which is just so strange coming from Obi-Wan Kenobi. But you do have to admit, you know, there's some really terrible dialogue in Star Wars. Really, really bad dialogue. I mean, you know, it was a groundbreaking movie in terms of special effects and creating characters and all that stuff, and at the time it came out, 1977, you know, it went through the roof. And it never really took off for me. I've never been a Star Wars guy. And I was 12 when the movie came out. I should have jumped head first into it. All my friends were losing their minds over it. And I was like,
Yeah, I was one of those guys.
I saw it a few times in the theater because my friends would go every other week. But that same year, there was another science fiction movie that came out. That's the one that I went nuts over. And that's the one that captured my imagination. It was Close Encounters. The one that got me. I didn't care about Star Wars, but I saw Close Encounters like 19 times in the theater. I love that movie. So,
it must mean something.
Yeah. All right. Alec Guinness, he hates Star Wars. Let's find out about more. If you know actors and actresses who have actually been in really terrible movies, but they're really good elsewise, what are the worst roles that you can think of for actors and actresses that you love? The news is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. And that's the Cars. Yeah. So, yeah. Nick DiGiulio here, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. And we're talking about actors and actresses who may be great, but have at least one role that they're embarrassed by, that they hate. And I would love to hear from you, good actors in bad roles. 312-981-7200. What are some examples of that, in your opinion? Good actors and actresses had with some terrible movies and terrible roles that they regret. 312-981-7200. The next one is Kelly Clarkson in From Justin to Kelly. With just a bad idea all the way around. Hot off of her win as the very first American Idol, Kelly Clarkson got to star in a film with her Idol runner-up, Justin Guarini. Unfortunately, that movie was From Justin to Kelly, a lame musical with dull songs, a nothing plot, and a skirt made out of ties that she had to wear. Turns out Clarkson never wanted to take the role of Kelly. I cried for a solid hour on the phone with the creator of American Idol and pleaded to let me out of my contract that said I had to film From Justin to Kelly. She said in Us Weekly. Luckily, the 2003 flop didn't hurt her career. Just don't expect a lot of Clarkson films in the near future. You know, the thing about that is that I don't know if it's still this way or not. But if you are on American Idol, you sign a contract and they basically own you. I mean, they own Kelly Clarkson. And, you know, they chose the kind of music that she was going to sing, you know, and, you know, like when she's touring with other American Idols and stuff. And I can't remember how long her contract was. I think it was like a 3-year contract or something where basically the American Idol people dictated what she sang, what she did, her appearances, everything. So when finally she got to do what she wanted to do, you know, and released like Since You've Been Gone around that time period, she was no longer under contract with American Idol and she could do the kind of things that she wanted to do. But man, that From Justin Kelly, oh my God. Oh, brutal. Brutal movie. Here's an interesting one. This is Sally Field. And you would think it would be like Smokey and the Bandit 2. But no, Sally Field chose The Amazing Spider-Man. The Amazing Spider-Man was not an amazing time for Sally Field. As Peter Parker's Aunt May, Field was given exciting scenes of giving out quiet advice, looking worried, and folding laundry. Needless to say, the Oscar winner wasn't happy about the role. Field later admitted she took the part as a favor and told Howard Stern that she tried to give the flat role some life, but you can't put 10 pounds of crap in a 5-pound bag. Though apparently Field's colorful expression of regret wasn't enough to deter another A-lister from trying out the part, this Marissa Tomei took up the torch as Spidey Aunt in 2016 Spider-Man Homecoming. Yeah, she hated him. Well, why am I blanking on his name? Garfield. What the hell's his first name? British guy who played Spider-Man was dating James? Emma Stone. No. Garfield. Adam Garfield. Is it Alan? Adam Garfield. I can't believe I'm blanking on the guy's name. But anyway, those were terrible. Those Amazing Spider-Man movies were terrible. So I'm not surprised that Sally Field was not happy with the role. Yeah. I will say this, though. Aunt May with Marissa Tomei was like, just the casting of Marissa Tomei in that role is very, it's kind of strange because like Aunt May's now hot, which is, which is pretty weird. So, all right. Bad actor, good actors in bad roles and roles that they regret. There's a lot of them. Let's see, here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve.
Hey, ever since you did your screening of Barefoot in the Park last month,
first thing that popped in my head was Electric Horseman, because I thought that was a horrible movie.
Wow, I totally disagree. I love Electric Horseman.
Oh, I figured you'd know if Redford or Fonda ever had a regret about making it.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. But I'm a fan of that movie. I think Electric Horseman is great, and I think they're both really good in it. So yeah, I don't know. I would have to look it up to see, you know, what their responses were to that.
No. I just this is just one man's opinion.
Yeah, I understand. All right, Steve. Thanks for the call.
Hey, yeah.
Take care. Yeah, I really liked Electric Horseman. I think it's a terrific movie.
It was Andrew Garfield.
Andrew, that's what I couldn't think of his name. Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, I had to look it up. It was driving me nuts, too.
Yeah. I knew Andrew Garfield. And, God, those Spider-Man movies that he was in were terrible. That's terrible. The second Amazing Spider-Man movie with Jamie Foxx. Oh, my God, was that bad.
I think that thing's disappeared from existence. You can't find it.
Well, you know what they, you know, the way they reimagined it now, with when they released Homecoming, you know, that was the movie that, in a lot of people's opinion, finally got Spider-Man right.
Mm-hmm.
My old producer Dan Shagru, he's a comic book guy, and Spider-Man is his favorite character. And he didn't even like the Sam Raimi movies, and because he thought they got the character wrong. And he said it wasn't until Homecoming and how they handle, you know, Spider-Man now in the Avengers and Captain America movies, that's the right way. That's the probably the most faithful and most correct version of the character. I love the Sam Raimi. Well, the third one's not very good. The third Sam Raimi movie. There's some cool stuff in it. I don't think it's as bad as its reputation, though. I mean, a lot of people hate that movie, Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, well, just some of the casting choices.
I thought the Sandman character was great.
He was fantastic.
It was, yeah, Thomas Hayden Church. Yeah. I thought that was great. Now, I understand people not happy about, like, the dancing, you know?
Well, yeah.
And how goofy the movie gets. But Sam Raimi makes goofy movies, you know? I mean, he does. That's what he gravitates towards. But the thing is, and the other problem with Spider-Man 3 was that it had the unfortunate timing of following Spider-Man 2, which is a phenomenal movie.
Yeah.
And that was my favorite comic book movie of all time until Logan. When I saw Logan, I was like, oh. So Logan's my favorite comic book movie of all time. But I love Spider-Man 2. I think Alfred Molina is great in it. I think everything about it is great. The action sequences, the effects. I love that movie. I was blown away by it. But, yeah. So, Andrew Garfield. He's a good actor, though. Andrew Garfield's a good actor.
Yeah, I like him.
Yeah, I think he's great. Not very good as Spider-Man, but he's made a lot of other movies that are really, really, he's quite good in them. Okay, here's a role that Bill Murray regrets. Garfield. Of course. I mean, I couldn't believe that Bill Murray was involved in it. And, you know, Bill Murray's made a couple of terrible movies, but Bill Murray's involvement in the 2004 CGI-assisted Garfield gave us all a very important lesson. Know your Coens. The Garfield script was written by Joel Coen, Cohen. Murray thought that meant he was getting an offer to work with the Coen brothers of Fargo and No Country for Old Men. The Coens don't have an H in their name. When he accepted one of his most embarrassing movie roles to date, unfortunately, the Garfield Joel had an H in his name and no history of quirky Oscar-winning films. And to be fair, Joel Coen did write Toy Story and Evan Almighty. Murray already agreed despite the Coen-Coen mix-up and didn't seem to enjoy his time as the lasagna-loving cat. Wait a minute. Okay, so first of all, Evan Almighty is a terrible movie. Toy Story is great. I'll give you Toy Story. Toy Story is a great movie, but Evan Almighty was terrible. Let me. Okay, so didn't he do the sequel? Didn't he do the sequel to Garfield? Am I nuts? Or I mean, he hated his. He got tricked into it, thinking it was one of the Coen brothers. He hated the experience. But then he did a sequel? I mean, you know, the pay must have been he must have been paid, you know, out the wazoo to do it. But I thought there was a sequel that Bill Murray.
Yeah, he was in the sequel.
See, I don't understand. Yeah. It must have been the money, man. I mean, they must have pulled up a Brinks truck in front of his house, you know.
Man, yeah.
But for someone who hated this movie, Garfield, he did do a sequel. So. All right. How about Michelle Pfeiffer's? Michelle Pfeiffer, Grease 2. Grease 2 has a fantastic... Grease 2 is a ridiculous movie, but I love it. It's one of those movies that's bad, but it's really fun to watch. And they had a big, we're going to bowl tonight. And it took place in a bowling alley, and they sang all about bowling. And I was like, am I really watching a movie with a song called We're Going to Bowl Tonight? And, you know, because Grease, many people consider Grease one of the classics of movies, you know, the original Grease. And it's a fun movie. It's a great movie. But I remember when Grease 2 came out. Oh, man. Was it Maxwell Caulfield was the lead in it? So Michelle Pfeiffer, not a fan of Grease 2. Though Grease helped make John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John household names, Grease 2 didn't make much of a splash. Playing Stephanie, a Rydell high schooler who's just looking for a quote-unquote cool rider, Michelle Pfeiffer does not look back on her Pink Lady day fondly. She says, I hated that film with a vengeance and could not believe how bad it was. At the time, I was young and I didn't know any better. Fortunately, Grease 2 didn't hurt her career, becoming a Hollywood A-lister and probably the most famous Catwoman before Anne Hathaway showed up. Pfeiffer, she even went on to star in another movie musical, Hairspray. I forgot she was in Hairspray. I totally forgot about that. And by the way, Michelle Pfeiffer, my opinion, best Catwoman ever. Best Catwoman ever. And Anne Hathaway, you know, I love Anne Hathaway, but that, you know, I didn't, what the hell was that, Dark Knight Rises? Yeah. Yeah. No. And Batman Returns, with Danny DeVito as the Penguin and Christopher Walken and her as the and Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman. That's my favorite Batman movie of all time. And it was one of the reasons why I like that movie is that it's not really a great Batman movie, but it's a really great Tim Burton movie. And it's got that feel to it more than, you know, I mean, it doesn't really feel like a Batman movie. It feels like a Tim Burton movie. And it's a much more personal movie than the original Batman from 89 was, which I also enjoyed. So, all right, let's take a break. Actors and actresses who have made bad movie choices and regret them. Terrible parts, terrible movies, good actors, good actresses. 312-981-7200. I want to hear from you guys out there. 312-981-7200. Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up. Shake it up. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. It's our first Triple Play, and that was The Cars. Got to hear three songs by The Cars. And more Triple Play coming up. It's one artist, three songs. Get your requests in now at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Get your Triple Play requests in now. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here, and we are talking about good actors in bad movies, good actresses, good actors with that have taken some terrible roles. We've got a whole bunch of them here, like the actors talking about how they absolutely hated some of the movies and totally regretted taking some of the characters. And we got some texts coming in. We'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. 301 area code says, Rafe Fiennes and Uma Thurman in The Avengers. Oh, brutal. That movie was brutal. And I think Sean Connery was the villain, if I remember correctly. Oh, my God, what a bad movie. Dear Nick, Paul Newman said he hated his first film, The Silver Chalice. He was a sculptor who made the chalice used at the Last Supper. He hated wearing a toga that showed his legs. Yeah, that's a pretty bad movie. 301 area code, Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's, most offensive Asian stereotype ever. That is brutal to watch. I mean, how they made that movie, how they allowed that kind of performance. I mean, I realize it was a different time, but you go back and watch that. And Breakfast at Tiffany's outside of Mickey Rooney is a really good movie. But man, that stuff is horrendous. Mark the Breadman said, my choice for a great actor in a terrible movie is Donald Glover in Solo. And this is coming from a huge Star Wars fan. I liked Solo. I'm like the only person on the planet that liked that movie. I liked it. I thought Donald Glover was fine. Perfectly cast as Lando Calrissian. How about this? Val Kilmer in The Island of Dr. Moreau. What a piece of crap movie that was. Pretty much everybody involved in that movie. Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando. My God. I mean, that movie was a train wreck. I mean, like, behind the scenes of what happened on that movie, the original director is a guy named Richard Stanley, you know, who co-wrote it and directed it and got fired. So he's on the set. If you guys know Island of Dr. Moreau, has been made three times. There was Island of Lost Souls in the 30s, and then in the 70s they did a version with Burt Lancaster called The Island of Dr. Moreau, and then that version in the 90s. And David Thewlis was in it, Val Kilmer, Fairuza Balk, all people who I really like. And so it's about this doctor on this island who does these experiments on these sort of animal-like creature slash men and women, but they're all, you know, they're just basically animals. And he does all kinds of, like, genetic experiments. And that's what the movie's about. So what happened was, Brando and Kilmer were a nightmare on the set of this movie. Absolute nightmare. Their behavior was ridiculous. They hated the director. They just, you know, they hated each other. And I think Thewlis was having an affair on the set or something to that effect. And it just was a nightmare. And they had horrible weather on top of that. So the production was shut down because of a typhoon. So that's millions and millions of dollars. And the budget kept going up. And Brando's behavior and Val Kilmer's behavior got weirder and weirder and weirder. And then finally, Richard Stanley gets fired. And this was like a passion project of his. He always wanted to do a remake of Island of Dr. Moreau. So, you know, he's got ridiculous actors. He's got horrible weather that wipes out, like, all the sets got wiped out. So they rebuild all that stuff, relocate, and then he gets fired. And the actors didn't like him. They suggested that, you know, like Brando and Kilmer both wanted Stanley fired, so they fire him. And this is the insane thing. And I can't believe he hasn't written a book about this. I know there's a documentary about the making of this movie, and it's fantastic because it's just such an insane story. So here's what this guy did, Richard Stanley. So he still had friends on the set, you know, because a lot of the people on the set sided with him because he was dealing with two lunatics and like really horrible circumstances trying to make this movie. So what he did was went back, snuck on the set because they hired John Frankenheimer to come in and direct it. And Frankenheimer, you know, a really great workman filmmaker. They brought him in and he's like, all right, I'll deal with these idiots and I'll make the movie. So Frankenheimer's got final credit on the movie. So what Richard Stanley does is stays on the set, goes to the makeup department, gets put in animal makeup so that he can see what's happening on his movie. So nobody knew he was there except for the people that helped him out, except for the people on the staff that knew he was in under the makeup. They didn't know. None of the actors, actresses, nobody on the set knew that the old director who had just gotten fired was observing everything that was happening on the set of this movie underneath the animal makeup. It's so crazy. I mean, it's so crazy. And then the movie ended up being insane. Like Brando wanted that little man. Brando wanted to have him. It wasn't originally written in the into the script. Brando liked him. He's like, oh, I want him in every scene. So the little guy, like the mini me version of Brando in it, not originally supposed to be in there, and so they had to make up scenes with this to put the little man in. Otherwise, Brando would like not would not be, come out to the set. And then Val Kilmer started doing imitations of Brando, right? It's crazy. If you see the movie, it feels like it. Like you can watch that movie and go, man, this is just a disaster. And it was a nightmare. And the backstory is just incredible. It's incredible. Island of Dr. Moreau. Terrible, terrible movie. Oh. Okay. We're going to take a break here, and if you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're talking about actors and actresses who have made bad movies and had regrets about some terrible roles that they played. 312-981-7200. News is coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Ben, who requested that, and what was that?
That was Cattle Drive by the Marshall Tucker Band, and we get that request from Scott out of Streamwood.
Okay, there you go. Couple more Marshall Tucker Band songs will be played for Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200. I was just told off the air, Vic, you're going to be excited about this as well.
Nickelback's coming to town. No. What?
No, the Punchkeys are coming in this morning.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That is exciting because my stomach is now growling, so okay.
Yeah, the Punchkeys will be here. As you know, Tuesday is Punchki, is Tuesday's Punchki Day, and the guys over at the Continental Bakery every year, we get the freshest. That's one of the advantages of working the overnight.
You know, I know this is how you know they're good, because I remember them from last year, 1 year ago. I can still remember.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know they're crazy good, and so Punchki Day is officially on Fat Tuesday, which is this coming Tuesday. Which, by the way, this coming Tuesday, I'm screening Mr. Smith Goes to Washington at the AMC Rosemont 18. Only $10 to get in. We're having a little food and dinner and drinks beforehand at Caddyshack, Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant. Right around 6 o'clock, have some dinner, have some food, hang out at Murray Brothers Caddyshack. We thank those guys for the partnership now. 15% off all your food. If you're a film club member and you got proof that you're going to go see Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you get 15% off all of your food. And the food is great, and the atmosphere is cool, and the management and the service, all great stuff. So we'll have a really cool dinner, 15% off, and then scoot on over to the movie theater at the AMC Rosemont 18 and see one of the greatest movies ever made. Like, truly, one of the best American films ever made, with one of Jimmy Stewart's most iconic performances. It is a terrific movie. If you've never seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you need to come and check it out. If you're a Jimmy Stewart fan, you need to see it. If you've seen it, but you've never seen it on the big screen, it's going to be real exciting to see this one on the big screen. I've never seen it on the big screen before, so I'm very, very, very excited. It's only $10 to get in. Parking is free at the movie theater, and 15% off all your food at Murray Brothers Caddyshack Restaurant. You can check out amctheaters.com for more information. amctheaters.com for more information. So the Punchkies are coming in this morning from Continental Bakery. We'll get those things all lined up. You think it's a coincidence that I came back to work on the morning that we're getting Punchkies? I don't know. I think that worked out pretty well. man.
You should get fewer than we do, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, they do bring in a giant box, and there's always leftovers, so we can put it outside, you know, like near the kitchen area where people will keep the food, and we can put them out there after the show is over. But, yeah, we can chow down on some Punchkies. That's coming up in a little while. They said they're going to be coming around 3-ish, so we'll get the guys from Continental Bakery in here and talk Punchkies and talk about the bakery and all that cool stuff. As boy, a whole year has gone by. That's amazing. I remember those punch geese too from last year, Vic. I remember them from every year.
Right.
Because these guys really make, and they're unbelievably fresh because the bakery is working, you know, like crazy.
Now, that does seem like a long time ago to me because it was obviously in the Tribune Tower. I can remember opening up the boxes and eating. That seems like longer than a year, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
To me, yeah.
Yeah, it does. Wow. So, yeah. All right. So, there you go. Okay, we're talking about actors and actresses, good actors and good actresses, who have made terrible movies, terrible choices, and regret some of the worst roles they've ever had. And we've got a lot more to talk about, and we're just getting some texts here. What do you guys think? Good actors, good actresses, bad movies, bad performances. 312-981-7200. Tom Hanks regrets doing the TV show Bosom Buddies. Oh, that disappoints me. I love Bosom Buddies, man. You know, I met Tom Hanks at the Chicago Film Critic Awards the year that Forrest Gump won. He had won. That's when he won two Oscars in a row. He won 2 years in a row. He won for Philadelphia in 93, and he won for Forrest Gump in 94. And I remember he came to town for the Chicago Film Critic Awards, and I came up to him, and I shook his hand, and I said, "Hey, listen. Now that you're, you know, Mr. Oscar, and you're all in the prestigious movies, and you're Oscar winner and stuff, don't forget about Bachelor Party. Don't think you're too good to talk about Bachelor Party." And then he goes, "No, I love that movie." So he was very cool about it. He was very cool about Bachelor Party. I think that movie's hilarious, Bachelor Party. It's hysterical.
It's one of my favorite Tom Hanks films.
And he's great in it. He's really, really funny in it. And so I was like, don't be getting all high and mighty because you're winning all these Oscars and stuff, man. Don't you forget about Bachelor Party. And he said he liked it. About John Candy's last movie, Wagons East. Oh, that was a terrible movie. That was a terrible movie. 231 area code says Sir Laurence Olivier in the 1980 version of The Jazz Singer. Oh, brutal. Yeah. Laurence Olivier did not speak kindly of that movie. Neil Diamond in The Jazz Singer. Soundtrack was pretty popular, though, but the movie was terrible. Lucy Arnaz, Neil Diamond, Laurence Olivier. Ooh. 773 area code says, "Hey Nick, glad you're back, and I hope you feel better." Righteous Kill for both Pacino and De Niro. Oh, another terrible movie. It says, "Take care, thank you." These guys, though, I mean, these guys have some pretty lousy roles on their resume, especially De Niro. Have you seen Dirty Grandpa with him and Zac Efron? One of the most embarrassing movies I've ever seen in my life. But I'll tell you, the worst Robert De Niro performance of all time. And he's been in, I mean, he was in the Rocky and Bullwinkle movie. He's made some, I mean, there, you know, in those Fokker movies, you know, I mean, he's been in some really terrible films and he has sleptwalked through a lot of movies, and so has Pacino. Then there was that period of time where every movie Pacino was in, he would scream every line. "What do you mean?" You know, like what? But the worst Robert De Niro performance, if you want to witness it, is in The Godsend, which is this horror movie. I want to say Greg Kinnear was in it. I can't remember who the female lead was. Dakota Fanning. I was going to say Dakota Johnson, but that's the wrong Dakota. Dakota Fanning, the little girl. She was in it. It's the most embarrassing performance Robert De Niro has ever given. I mean, it is just ridiculously bad. So, how about next one here? Whoopi Goldberg. She was in a movie called Theodore Rex. Whoopi Goldberg didn't just regret signing up for the cop dinosaur buddy comedy Theodore Rex. She sued to get out of it, and based on the film's IMDb description, we won't blame her. This is the description. In an alternate futuristic society, a tough female police detective is paired with a talking dinosaur to find the killers of dinosaur and other prehistoric animals. I have to admit, I've never seen this one. Pretty, you know, I mean, it's pretty legendary in terms of how bad the reputation is. Then it says, unfortunately for Goldberg, the producers insisted she fulfill her contract or pay millions of dollars in fines. So she had to suck it up and play scenes against a guy in a dinosaur suit. Ultimately, the film cost $35 million and was released direct-to-video. And it has a 0% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. All right. Jessica Alba. Well, Jessica Alba's been in a lot of bad movies. I mean, it's kind of hard to single out because she really is a pretty terrible actress. Cry pretty, Jessica, said the director of The Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, to star Jessica Alba. Throughout the film, Alba was pretty much told to just stand there and look pretty. The director said they'd CGI in the tears to avoid having an ugly crying face. The condescending direction made the superhero sequel extremely unpleasant. In fact, she almost quit acting because of her bad experience as Sue Storm. For better or worse, Alba has continued to appear in movies like Little Fockers, The Love Guru, and the Entourage movie. Alba also runs The Honest Company, a nearly billion-dollar health and wellness brand. All right, let's see. Mariah Carey, Glitter. Oh, man. I remember when that movie came out the weekend after September 11th. It came out the weekend after September 11th. I remember that because there were reports that in movie theaters in New York City that people were going to see Glitter, and there weren't that many people because the movie was a massive turkey. But there were reports that when a shot of the World Trade Center happened in the movie, there was spontaneous breaking out into applause. So people were applauding just the shot. And it was the only good thing that people thought about the movie, was it? Meant to be Mariah Carey's launch into movie stardom, Glitter became the biggest bomb of her career. With a 7% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, the film was criticized for being cliche, maudlin, and heroically bad. Carey hated the film so much, she made people call it the G word and said it's the biggest regret of her career. Since then, Carey received good reviews for supporting roles in Precious, The Butler, and Girls Trip, but Billy Frank still haunts her, the character she played. Fortunately, Carey can always fall back on her day job as the third best-selling female artist in history, second only to Madonna and Rihanna. Yeah, Glitter was terrible. Yeah. Let's see. Here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good morning, Nick. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I got a couple for you. Well, Michael Caine has a number of movies, but the one I'm thinking of is The Shining Adventure, The Return.
Yeah.
Michael Caine, and he's a quality actor, and that's a movie surely didn't...
Well, Michael Caine has openly admitted that he took a lot of roles for money. Like, he was in Jaws, The Revenge. Which is one of the worst movies ever made, and they asked why he did it, and he said, because I could spend 3 months in Bermuda with my wife.
Yeah, that's why they do those kind. You got William Shatner, who's, I think, a pretty good actor in the right role. He has a Kingdom of the Spiders.
Yeah, that's a terrible movie.
And then my top one, the reason I'm pretty much calling, was and this movie's so bad it's good. In fact, so good I bought a DVD of it just because it's funny. Ray Milland in Two-Headed Transplant.
Right, with Rosie Grier.
Yep. I mean, Ray Milland is a really good actor.
Yeah.
You see him in that movie, man. It's like,
yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible, but it is one of those movies that's hilarious because it's so bad.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
Okay, thank you, Rich.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Take care, bye. You know, but Ray Milland in that period in the 70s was making a lot of crappy movies. He did a lot of crappy movies. And I mean, Incredible Two-Headed Transplant is just, I mean, that's the pinnacle. But he also made a movie called Frogs, which was about nature striking back and killing people. So, and but they were all of the animals that would kill people in the movie were being controlled by the frogs. So there'd be these shots of frogs in the movie, like sort of, you know, hypnotizing other animals and getting them to kill humans. And it was supposed to be like an eco movie, like an environmental kind of a statement, because Ray Milland's character is like this rich guy who runs like a bunch of corporations that dump a bunch of crap into the water and pollute the world and stuff. And so it's the animals taking revenge. And it's called Frogs. It is really a really
At first, I thought you were describing an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Well, yeah, you mean The Happening, which is also a horrendous movie. But but the thing about Frogs is that it stars a Sam Elliott sans mustache. Sam Elliott, no mustache. Oh,
I got to watch it now.
Yeah. Yeah, you want to see Sam Elliott without the mustache. So... gets a little weird to get used to. You know, you're like, wait a minute, is that Sam Elliott? Because I don't see the big bushy mustache.
Yeah, I've got, you know, and we've mentioned this, I've got my list of must watch movies now, courtesy of you.
Yeah.
And that just jumped to the top of the list.
Oh, it's a terrible, keep in mind, it's a terrible
movie. Oh, those are the best, though.
It's a terrible movie. Ray Milland. Whew. Yeah, that was a bad time for him. In between that and the incredible two-headed thing, or whatever the hell it's called, the transplant thing with Rosie Greer. God. Okay. That, by the way, that incredible two-headed transplant movie, I think Sven's shown that a couple of times. I'm pretty sure Sven Gulli showed that a couple of times. Yeah, he did. He did. So, all right, we got a break here. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, more actors and actresses who have made really bad decisions and made bad movies and played terrible roles. 312-981-7200 if you would like to join us. 312-981-7200. Okay, we'll have more after this. Welcome back, everybody. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, Major Play Thursday! Continues. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200 for your Triple Play request. 312-981-7200. It's Marshall Tucker Band over there with the Triple Play. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios, 18 lovely floors above downtown Chicago. Here until 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. We've been talking about actors and actresses, good actors, good actresses, who have made some weird decisions, who have made some bad movies and played some bad roles. Some of those actors and actresses have spoken out with their displeasure over some of the work that they've done and over some of the movies that they've been in, and we've been reading about a bunch of them here on Collider.com. So here's our next one. And by the way, if you want to jump in, good actor, bad movie, bad performance, that happens. 312-981-7200. Jamie Lee Curtis chose the movie Virus. This is a movie I completely forgot about until I was looking at this story. It says, remember 1999's Virus? Probably not. And Jamie Lee Curtis is perfectly fine with that. In an interview for the 2018 Halloween, Curtis went out of her way to call the movie a piece of... what? You know what. Starring Curtis, William Baldwin, and Donald Sutherland, Virus is about an alien species looking to turn humans into cyborgs. Curtis really regretted saying yes to the movie. It's so bad that it's shocking, she told an interviewer. That's the only good reason to be in bad movies. Then when your friends have bad movies, you can say, ah, I've got the best one, and I'm bringing Virus. Yeah, I mean, I had forgotten completely about that movie. Yeah, jeez. These are also movie and TV roles. if you want to jump in. Angus T. Jones. Two and a Half Men. Angus T. Jones, the kid in the highly rated Charlie Sheen sitcom Two and a Half Men, was not a fan of his own show. Though not technically a movie, we think Jones' plight deserves honorary mention since he starred in the series for 12 years before begging people to stop watching it. Before the 10th season, after Sheen's scandal and video ramblings, Jones posted a video calling the show filth. He said he no longer wanted to be a part of the CBS program and urged viewers to watch anything else. Oddly enough, Jones continued with the show two more years. Maybe it became less filthy, or maybe he was very happy to make at least $350,000 an episode. $350,000 an episode? Wow. It's still nothing compared to what Depp made. Charlie Sheen made. I mean, he was getting some ridiculous amount of money, wasn't he? Like, he was the highest paid. He was the highest paid guy on TV at one point, right? For Two and a Half Men.
Yeah, along with the highest guy on TV.
Yeah, I never watched. I've never seen a full episode of that show. It's on. It's on here in the studio every night.
I say every night we're in.
So I see it, you know, but I've never watched an entire. At least with sound, you know, paying attention.
A friend of mine from high school was on an episode. That's about the only one I watched.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The only thing consistent thing that I notice about when that show's on is that there were a lot of very attractive women on that show.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think that's one of the reasons why people watched it for such a long time is because the women that were unbelievably beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like every episode, there's like two or three really beautiful women on the show. And I just noticed that. And, you know, I just noticed that over the past, you know, time watching it in the studio here. I'm like, wow. No wonder people watch this show. All right, here's Dave on WGN. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
I'm thinking of a movie back to the early to mid 70s. It's called Capricorn.
Capricorn 1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A really serious movie, you think, for most of the part, but then the ending is so ridiculously stupid. Where they escape that hangar or bunker that they're trying to stage that fake Mars landing in.
Right.
And then they're at a funeral for one of the astronauts, and one of the husbands comes running into the funeral, and they're all shocked and surprised, and it's just so bizarre and horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible screenwriting.
I'm actually, this is another one that I like. I love Capricorn 1. That's two movies now that we've had callers call in on that I actually really like. Electric Horseman, I love that movie, and I love Capricorn 1.
Because it was so ridiculous, I guess, right?
No, because I think it's good.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I think it's really good, actually. A great conspiracy movie, one of those great, you know, conspiracy movies. And O.J. Simpson's in it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, I love Capricorn 1. Love it. Showed it at my film club a few years ago. Yeah, it's one of those great conspiracy theory movies. James Brolin is in it. Come on, man. Elliot Gould, Brenda Vaccaro. Like I mentioned, OJ is in it. Sam Waterston. Hey, you mentioned Hal Holbrook. Yeah, no, I think that movie rules. So. But, hey, everybody's got their own opinion, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about actors and actresses, good movies, bad, good actors, good actresses in really terrible movies and bad performances. 312-981-7200. The news is coming up after this. And I'm searching for rainbows. And if the wind never showed me where to go, all right. This old man, Ron, she's getting kind of welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're here live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. The Punchkis are on their way. You know, Punchki Day is Tuesday, and the guys over at Continental Bakery every year bring us the early supply of Punchkis. And one of the great things about working the overnights is we're the first ones to get the punch keys, and they're the freshest ones. So that's coming in. Everybody get your stomach ready to be filled with punch keys because they're big and they're good. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We are talking about good actors, good actresses who make mistakes. They've been in some really terrible movies and had some terrible roles. And if you would like to jump in with your, oh boy, he's a good actor or she's a good actress, but that was bad, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Hey, by the way, Ben, you were here for the Hawks game, right?
Yeah. All right. I was so producing it. Yeah.
So you didn't see the Masked Singer?
No, okay. I did not.
Because it's the finale.
Yeah.
And it's two hours long.
I know. I'm debating staying up when I get home before my flight and just catching it and then flying out.
Well, I'm definitely watching it when I get home. Yeah. No, there's no question about it. But it's the 2 hours. I can't believe it's 2 hours. I don't know. What are they going to do to fill that time?
I hope
there's only three singers left. I mean, yeah. I mean, what are we going to do here?
There's no guest judge.
I don't know.
This time, is there?
I don't know. Boy, Kena Thompson was a blast last week.
Yeah,
Kena Thompson was great, and so was J.B. Smoove. I mean, actually,
I loved all of them.
Yeah,
so
Joel McHale. Yeah. It was. Yeah, the guest judges were great. I just happen to be a really big Kena Thompson fan. I just think he's great. But yeah, so there it is. It's the big. The big finale that I will watch when I get home in the morning of the dumbest show ever.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, okay. All right, so good actors, good actresses, bad movies, bad choices. Here's Johnny Depp, and he chose 21 Jump Street. The 1987 TV series 21 Jump Street made Johnny Depp a star, but he never wanted to be on it. Even before he was famous, he never wanted to do TV and only auditioned for the cop drama because he was quote-unquote broke. Despite having a horrible flu, Depp nailed the audition and became a major star. But he still hated the role of Tom Hansen. I felt I was in a prison creatively, said Depp. So he trashed his trailer and did whatever he could to get out of his contract early. Still, it didn't stop him from reprising the role as Officer Tom Hansen in the 2012 movie 21 Jump Street. Yeah, I was shocked when he showed up in the movie. Because, I mean, he's made it very, very clear that he hated doing 21 Jump Street. So when he showed up as in a cameo in the movie version. Which, by the way, both of those movies are funny. 21 Jump Street and 22 Jump Street, those are both funny movies, and I didn't expect them to be funny at all.
I had a hint. Like, I felt like they would be just by the pairing they did.
Yeah. It's just that I'm suspicious of any movie that's like based on a bad TV show.
Well, I'll agree with you.
You know what I mean? That's how is this going to be good? But Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum were great in it. I mean, they really worked well together, too. There was a lot of chemistry between the two of them. So... here you go, Will Smith. Will Smith has made a lot of bad movies. Here's the thing about Will Smith. I can't name multiple movies that I liked that Will Smith movies that I like. I like Men in Black, the original. I like the original Men in Black.
Yeah.
I'm alone on this one, but I like I Am Legend. But. Like, I hated Independence Day with a passion. I look back at his movies and I just like, what? After Earth? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, some of them. I like his ones where it's just flat out entertaining.
Like, what was that one where he was the drunk superhero? The hell was the name of that movie?
Hancock.
Terrible movie.
Yeah.
I mean, he's made a lot of bad movies. Will Smith has made more bad movies than good and more terrible movies than good.
What did you think of Wild Wild West?
Hated it. And that's the one that Will Smith regrets. He says that Will Smith was getting used to having a major box office success every 4th of July until Wild Wild West came out. Though the film made back its budget, it was far from the success of Independence Day and Men in Black, plus critics hated it. Years after the film, Smith admitted he made Wild Wild West because he thought it would be a huge hit. Now he tries to pick up films based on quality rather than global box office. I have to be in tune with the fans and their needs and not trick them into going to see a movie like Wild Wild West. So Will Smith doesn't like Wild Wild West. So this is an interesting one here, because this is absolutely true. Burt Reynolds hated Boogie Nights, despite the fact that it got him an Oscar nomination, and he got the critical response was through the roof, and it was like a second chapter in his career that could have gone in a pretty spectacular way. But he was notoriously he hated it. He hated Boogie Nights. So, though Boogie Nights brought Burt Reynolds critical acclaim and much-needed career boost, Reynolds never himself liked the movie. On set, he clashed with director Paul Thomas Anderson and later said he'd never work with Anderson again. As for the film itself, Reynolds never even saw it. Supposedly, the movie made him uncomfortable and once said, "It's not my kind of film." Reynolds hated the experience so much that he fired his agent that got him an Oscar-nominated role. Ironically, he's never expressed the kind of resentment for some of the less than acclaimed roles, like in Dukes of Hazzard, Cannonball Run 2, or Meet Wally Sparks. So, all right. I think the guys are here. Can we get them in? The Continental Bakery guys are here for the annual Punchkies. Hey, man.
Greetings. Wow, this is nice.
Right here. Take a seat right there.
Put the
box right over here.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'll take the notes.
Okay. Well, this is just some additional stuff.
Okay, I got to turn a mic on for you here. Hold on a second.
What's up?
All right, there you go. How you doing, man?
Okay.
All right, it's good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm by myself today because...
Into that mic.
Hello, hello?
Yeah.
But I hear nothing.
You got to turn up the volume.
Oh, didn't know I had control. There we go. Wow, hot setup, huh?
All right, so you're all... Introduce yourself and talk about the Continental Bakery.
I'm Bill from Central Continental Bakery. Usually Steve is with me, but we were extra busy tonight, so he couldn't quite do it. So
okay,
I'm doing this by myself. And
how many years have you come down here now with Punchkies?
One, two, three. I think it's got to be 7 or 8.
Yeah, it's got to be. That sounds about right.
Because we came the last year that Steve and Johnny were here.
Mm-hmm.
The next time was you. And then it was 2 times with Bill Leff, and then it's been you ever since.
Right.
So you've taken over.
Oh, as far as, like, most visits from you guys?
Yeah.
All right. All right, well, here's what we got here. Now, tell everybody what a Punchki is.
The easiest way to describe it is it's a Bismarck with a richer dough with all sorts of good stuff stuffed inside of it.
Right.
Custard, fruit. Well, you've got a list of a bunch of the stuff there. There's like,
so the top flavors here, you sold 40,000 in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
40,000 just out of Central Continental Bakery.
Mm-hmm.
40,000 Punchkies, man. That's a lot of
Imagine Punchkies. Imagine that. Try to stack those on these tables here.
That's crazy. So your top flavors this was for 2018.
Yeah.
The chocolate custard, strawberry, cream cheese, raspberry, strawberry cheese, strawberry whipped cream, but people like strawberries. Mm-hmm. Strawberry banana custard, cannoli, apple caramel, cherry, and chocolate mousse.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So this is what we got for our show here. You brought down my favorite, which is the banana custard.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite Punchki. We got some key lime. We got chocolate mousse, Oreos and cream. We got strawberry whipped cream, Mardi Gras, sea salt with caramel, cherry cheese, tiramisu, and strawberry banana custard. And there's a dozen. You brought in a dozen for our show. Now, and you brought more for the other shows, too, right?
Well, they all have your name on it, so they're going to have to ask your permission.
Oh, is that right? And those, but you bring it for most of the, for the daytime shows?
Yeah.
And but I'm the first to get one.
Yeah.
All right. That's fantastic. How long have you been with Central Continental?
23 years.
23 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the busiest time of year, correct?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, what else do you guys tell me a little bit more about Central Continental Bakery? You guys are a full-service bakery, right?
Yep. Wedding cakes, donuts, also anything you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, our retail store in Mount Prospect is 24 hours on Monday.
Ah, yes.
I want to make sure I say that.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that on any of these notes, I don't think.
Because Monday is you guys
the day before Fat Tuesday.
Yeah, it's going to be insane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 40,000 you went through last year.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect to go through that many this year?
I would imagine so. It's been 40 to 50 somewhere in there last at least 7 or 8 years, I'm pretty sure.
Wow, that's great. That's really crazy. Now, how many stops do you have to make today?
About 8, 9, something like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually count them, but that's about that.
Yeah. So you're busy all the way up until, is this going to be a busy day for you?
No, I'll be done by 6 o'clock or so,
yeah.
I think.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for bringing the Punchkies.
You're quite welcome.
And Central Continental Bakery, you guys have a website?
Yeah. It's on the sheet there, centralcontinentalbakery.com.
Centralcontinentalbakery.com.
3-dub.
All right.
As you would expect.
Exactly. And yeah, the phone number is 847-806-9373.
Mm-hmm.
And there it is, Central Continental Bakery Annual Punchki Fest for 2019. And there are so many different. You can get, like a full dozen assortment, right? And you get a half dozen assortment.
Mm-hmm.
And it all varies.
Yeah. What?
Yeah. Okay.
There's assortments that are set up there, but you can
mix and match.
Yeah, I imagine.
Okay. Well, very cool. So we got banana custard, we got key lime, chocolate mousse, Oreo and cream, strawberry whipped cream, Mardi Gras, and sea salt with caramel, cherry cheese, tiramisu, and the strawberry banana custard. And we thank you for that. And then the other shows got their own punchkies too.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Thank you for doing this. It's always a lot of fun.
Unless you're real hungry and go through those, and
I can't. If you've seen the size of these things, because they're really big. I mean, and I think one punchki is about all I can muster at this point. Yeah. And I've been having some serious stomach issues over the past like 4 days.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna have to. I'm going to have to take it easy for the punchkies this year. But we really appreciate you coming down.
Just take a bite or two and then, put it in the fridge.
Absolutely, because it'll last all week. So, all right. So we got our punchkies. We thank you. And 24 hours in Mount Prospect.
Mm-hmm. On Monday.
Open 24 hours. So you can get your punchki needs for mm-hmm. 24 hours. And it's going to be crazy busy. When you guys are open for 24 hours, are there, do you have lines?
I've heard there are. I've never been there during it.
Oh, okay.
I'm usually working and elsewhere.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I've heard there can be some lines that mount up at times.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
But,
well, they're great. The punchkies. All right.
Very popular, as you know.
They're very, very popular. They're very, very popular. And again, this is we want to thank Central Continental Bakery for all the punchkies. CentralContinentalBakery.com, and you can call 847-806-9373. And again, open 24 hours on Monday. All right. Thank you, man.
I can hear your voices, can I?
Yeah. And it's been a rough 4 or 5 days. So.
But you're a professional.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Here you go.
I don't really need this.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Just leave it there then. Yeah. I'll take care of it. Okay. Well, there you go. Thank you guys very much.
You can always shred it if you don't
have it. Okay.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot.
All right. Our pleasure. All right. We're going to take a break and then we're going to eat some punchkies. So there you go. And we will be back right after this break.
Everybody plays the fool sometimes. There's no exception to the rule. Listen, baby, it may be factual, maybe cruel.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here, 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. We're going to get back to our conversation about good actors and good actresses who made bad decisions and made bad movies. Who's the request? And tell everybody who that is.
That this request comes from the 301 area code, and that was Everybody Plays the Fool by The Main Ingredient.
That's right. So yeah. We'll hear two more Main Ingredient songs because it's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday! 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. So the next actor that is a good actor but has made a bad movie here, that would be Roy Scheider in Jaws 2. Jaws is considered to be the first summer blockbuster. It made tons of money, had fans galore, and Roy Scheider was critically praised for his leading role. None of those things can be said about Jaws 2. Though the sequel did well financially, it was a critical dud. Scheider only did the film because of contractual obligation. He was supposed to film the lead in The Deer Hunter, but had problems with the character, so he dropped out. Since he owed the production company a movie, he was forced to do Jaws 2, though he never liked the script. I did not know that he was up for The Deer Hunter. I had no idea that he was up for The Deer Hunter. That's crazy. So he ended up making Jaws 2 instead of The Deer Hunter. Oof. That's another aspect of these roles that we're talking about, like maybe what they could have made, what the actor or actress could have done instead. And then they ended up doing these terrible movies and we're stuck with them. I just remember that the way the shark died in Jaws 2 was one of the most ridiculous things I've ever seen. If I remember correctly, Roy Scheider is banging on a giant power cable with an oar to attract the shark. Like a big black power cable. And so he's banging on it to get the shark to show up. And then the shark jumps up and bites the power cable and it electrocutes himself and his eyes like explode out of his mouth or out of his face. Yeah, killed via cable, power cable. Yeah, man, Jaws 2. Made a lot of money, but it was really stupid. I remember seeing it, my folks and I went to see it at the Gulf Mill Theater in Niles, and it was packed. And because Jaws was a massive, everybody knows this. I'm speaking, something that everybody already knows. But that movie, Jaws, was like a monster hit. And so, of course, when Jaws 2 came out, everybody went nuts. Now, Spielberg did not have anything to do with this one. And it turned out to be pretty bad, but I'm telling you, the power cable thing, so ridiculous. All right, Josh Brolin, his choice, Jonah Hex, which is a movie that went through, I think, a lot of behind the scenes changes and cuts and stuff like that. Josh Brolin was acclaimed for bringing to life Marvel comic book characters of Cable and Thanos in Deadpool 2, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Avengers Infinity War. But he was not so acclaimed for the big screen adaptation of Jonah Hex. Brolin wanted to make a low-budget Western, but got a CGI disaster instead. In an interview, Brolin said, "Oh, Jonah Hex, hated it. The experience of making it, that would have been a better movie." And that's saying something from someone who agreed to star in Spike Lee's remake of Old Boy, which is another terrible movie. Not the original. The original is great. The original Old Boy is fantastic. That's a great movie. And there was absolutely no reason to remake that movie. Let's see. We got some text coming in. If you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. 331 area code says, Katharine Hepburn in the remake of Love Affair with Beatty and Benning. I think was that her last movie? I think it was her last movie. 773 area code, welcome back, Nick. How about Russell Crowe in Les Mis? Oh, man. Oh, brutal. Oh. Yeah, I mean, it was an embarrassing performance, and like the singing is just awful. That was a terrible movie too. The whole thing was bad, but Russell Crowe stood out as the top bad thing about that movie, and there are a lot of bad things about that movie. 815 area code, Clinton Spilsbury in The Legend of the Lone Ranger, one and done. Thanks, that's Robert. First of all, one of the most ridiculous names ever. I remember when that movie came out. I remember when the Lone Ranger movie came out. I want to say it was like 79 or something like that. Clinton Spilsbury? What is that? Clinton Spilsbury. Yeah, and he was, man, they were touting him as the next big thing, man. man, I just remember all the press that that guy got, all the attention, and then the movie was awful, and it tanked at the box office. You know, Johnny Depp was in that Lone Ranger movie with Armie Hammer. That was a terrible movie, too. But Clinton Spilsbury, there's a name right there we won't forget. So, okay, we got a break for the news, and then we'll wrap up this topic and get into some other stuff. 312-981-7200. Again, I want to thank the guys at Central Continental Bakery for annually bringing in the punchkis. They're here. They're ready to go. Vic, you want to come in here and grab one after the news? Please do.
I got one already.
Oh, you
thank
got one already.
You to them.
There you go. Awesome. So they're here. And they're ready to go. All right, we're going to take a break. The news is coming up after this, and then more bad movies and bad performances from good actors and good actresses. Okay? All right. News is up after this.
Only moments a day. I just don't want to be lonely. I'd rather be loved and needed. Depending on to give a love I can't give when you're gone.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we're here till 5. We got the punchkis. They're all here. We want to thank Central Continental Bakery again. And Vic, what kind did you get?
It's got some chocolate on the top, but I can't tell what's inside.
Ah, okay.
I haven't dug in yet.
All right. I always go with the banana cream. That's my favorite punchkis, banana cream. There's chunks of real banana in it. And I took like 2 bites and I'm like, this is going to, and they're so, I mean, you got to have 50 napkins when you eat these things. There's like the size of a hubcap.
I mean, I would also need a bucket because the floodgates just open when I start eating. That's why I haven't eaten mine yet. Saliva will not stop for hours. I'll need to keep eating.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But they're so delicious.
Well, they look amazing.
Yeah, and it is just once a year because they're pretty indulgent, man.
You know what? They got some weight to them.
Oh, they do. No, seriously.
I'm not kidding.
This thing is hefty.
Got to be maybe half pound.
Oh, yeah, it's got to be.
Yeah, at least maybe a little
more. Got to be. And then, you know, you take a bite out of it and then like all the banana cream comes out and everything and it's just, it's delicious.
I'm just going to eat mine in the shower.
Just save the middleman right there.
Right. Isn't that KP? I think I heard KP saying that was his go-to method for eating stuff like that.
Is that right? Just go eat it in the shower.
Right.
Save yourself some time. That's funny.
I wonder how many Kevin could down. Kevin can eat.
Oh, man. Yeah.
With how much Kevin
can eat. He enjoys food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He and I talk quite frequently about that one.
Yeah. No. He's a food guy. There's no question about it. We have him on regularly to talk sports, and then we end up talking about food at some point. So
sounds about right.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to, you know, opening day's coming up. So they have the day at the park where we find out all the new foods.
All the new
park.
Food,
so,
yeah. That, and get so to sample all of it. Yeah, that should be good. That should be good. All right. Well, the punchkis are here, everybody. Get your punchkis. Monday, 24 hours. Central Continental Bakery is open for 24 hours. And they get lines at like 3 o'clock in the morning. People waiting in line for the punchkis. And Fat Tuesday just around the corner, everybody. All right. We're talking about good actors and good actresses who have not been happy about certain performances and who have given bad performances and starred in bad movies. This next one really disappoints me. Like, really, really, really disappoints me. Blake Lively doesn't like Gossip Girl. How is that even possible? Though Gossip Girl made Blake Lively famous, she was not always a fan of her character. Lively complained about getting new pages of the script minutes before filming, and as the show went along, she felt like she was just part of a machine rather than creating something worthwhile. Since the CW show, Lively has gone on to star in Age of Adeline, The Town, A Simple Favor, Cafe Society, and The Shallows, all while raising 2 kids and probably helping Ryan Reynolds memorize his Deadpool lines. After all, the two did meet on another comic movie, Green Lantern. That disappoints me. I mean, because I'm a Gossip Girl fan. That's too bad. All right, Janine Garofalo does not like the truth about cats and dogs. Neither do I. You're not alone, Janine. The 1996 rom-com, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, put indie darling Janine Garofalo into the mainstream. Though the film brought Garofalo great success, she does not enjoy it. I have no idea why that film appeals to anyone. I can't stand that film, she said. According to the actress, the film was originally meant to be an indie with a happy ending, but was changed into a sappy studio venture when Uma Thurman signed on. Garofalo has enjoyed success ever since, with major roles in 24 Wet Hot American Summer and the subsequent Netflix prequel series, Metalopolis, and The Girlfriend's Guide to Divorce. Yeah, Truth About Cats and Dogs is a terrible movie. Now, this is a famously here for this one. Chevy Chase and Community. Well, he hated doing the show because, you know, he had run-ins with Dan Harmon, but that was the funniest thing he did in years. Like, there was a stretch, like a long stretch of many years where Chevy Chase was just not doing anything good, was not funny. But when he came in, when he showed up on Community, he was really funny on that show. And I love that show. Though the NBC sitcom Community revitalized Chevy Chase's career and gave him the opportunity to make fans for a whole new audience, Chevy Chase had nothing but disdain for the program. Along with fighting with his co-stars Yvette Nicole Brown and Donald Glover, Chase saved his true ire for creator Dan Harmon. Chase famously ranted to Harmon, "It's just an effing mediocre sitcom. I want people to laugh, and this isn't funny." He is a notoriously difficult actor who doesn't have many kind words to say about anyone. That includes notables such as President Ford, Will Ferrell, Johnny Carson, Bill Murray, and Howard Stern, among others. Yeah, I mean, I don't understand. I mean, he's just notoriously a jerk. I've read basically every book about SNL that you can possibly read. You know, the classic Live from New York, which is like, that's the Bible of all SNL books. I read Jay Moore's book about SNL. I've read like a few other books about SNL. I've read everything there possibly could be written about SNL. And there is not one person who contributes to any of these books that doesn't have a story about how much of a jerk Chevy Chase is. So one of my favorites is when Chevy Chase came back to host. And it's you know, this is kind of a notorious SNL story. He came back to host, and this was after he left the show and was talking smack about the rest of the cast and how much, you know, he left after the first season because he was going to be a movie star. And he, when he came back to host, he was so insanely difficult to work with. Like, he was, you know, and he was hogging the spotlight and everything. He was stealing focus from all the other performers. And Bill Murray had joined the cast, you know, replacing Bill Murray or replacing Chevy Chase when he left. So he had like a run in with Chevy Chase. Bill Murray had a run in with Chevy Chase, backstage at SNL. And then was told by John Belushi that Chevy Chase was talking smack about him. Was talking smack about Bill Murray. So Bill Murray and Chevy Chase got into a fight, like a physical fight. And if you watch the last, you know, the goodbyes of that episode, this classic episode, if you watch the goodbyes, you know, when everybody's on the stage and the credits are rolling and everybody says goodbyes, you can see Bill Murray having to be held back because Chevy Chase is up there saying the goodbyes and Bill Murray wants to kill him. You could just see that Bill Murray is seething and he's got his fists clenched and he wants to punch Chevy Chase so badly. And then the funny thing is, if you watch Belushi, Because it's all Belushi's fault. Belushi started all the crap. He's the one who wanted to see the two of them fight. So he told Bill Murray and was goading him on. If you watch, you know, first of all, you see like half the cast trying to hold Bill Murray back. Chevy Chase being a jerk, center stage, you know, talking and saying goodbyes. And then, so Bill Murray's being held back, but you can see Belushi like laughing. Because he was always a sneaky dude who would like to play tricks on people. But yeah, if you watch the closing credits to that episode where Chevy Chase, the first time Chevy Chase came back to host, Belushi's priceless at the end. Just priceless. You could tell that he was so happy that he got these two guys into a fight and Bill Murray was so infuriated. You could just see the look on his face. So that's one of my favorite, SNL stories. Again, proving once again what a jerk Chevy Chase is. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hi. Going back to Clinton Spilsbury and the Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
After they filmed the movie, the company, the producers, decided his voice was so weak that they redubbed the entire movie with James Keane doing the dialogue.
That's right. I totally forgot about that detail. Forgot about that. Wow. Yep.
A couple of other examples, the movie Greystoke, Andy McDowell, who played right. Jane, couldn't do a British accent. They had Glenn Close redo all her dialogue.
Yep.
And then the really sad one, in the last Peter Sellers Pink Panther movie, they brought back all the people from the original, Robert Wagner, David Niven. David Niven had a stroke or something. You couldn't understand any of his dialogue, so you brought in Rich Little
right.
to redo all of his lines.
Yep. I know that story. I had forgotten about the Clinton Spilsbury, though. But, yeah, David Niven, you know, the voice was done by Rich Little, which is crazy. Completely crazy. Okay. All right, John, thanks for those details, buddy. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Well, let's take a quick break here for some weather, and then we'll wrap up this conversation about good actors, good actresses, bad movies, bad performances. And if you want to jump in with your thoughts on that, 312-981-7200. And then I got some fun Easter eggs that you can look for in movies. And we'll tell you all about that as well. But let's get to the forecast right now with the WGN Weather Center. For today, mostly cloudy and chilly, high in the upper 20s. Afternoon flurries possible. Tomorrow, clouds mixed with sun, high in the mid-30s. Saturday, mostly cloudy, breezy, high of 32. A few flurries could fall early. Sunday, cloudy, chance of snow, then clearing, high in the mid-teens, and then Monday, mostly sunny and in the single-digit highs. Current temperature, 12 degrees at O'Hare. It's 15 at Midway and 17 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and wrap up the conversation about good actors, bad performances. Right after this on 720 WGN.
The moon may be high, but I can't see a thing in the sky.
Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And we are here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. That continues. That's the main ingredient. And a texter reminds us that the main ingredient's lead singer is Cuba Gooding Sr. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. All right, welcome back, everybody. And we are talking about actors and actresses who are good but have made some bad movies and regret some of the roles that they played. Denise Crosby regrets Star Trek The Next Generation. I was miserable. I couldn't wait to get off that show. I was dying, said Denise Crosby, about her year on Star Trek The Next Generation. Crosby found the character unfulfilling and was scared to death of the idea of standing around in that uniform years and years to come. Since then, Crosby's appeared in The Walking Dead, Scandal, Dexter, Mad Men, Star Trek Now, Voyager. She was producer on both the documentaries Trekkie and the sequel Trekkies 2. Additionally, the actress lent her vocal talent to Star Trek Amanda and Star Trek Online video games. So for someone who hated Star Trek, she certainly does a lot of Star Trek stuff. Mandy Patinkin, Criminal Minds. Though Mandy Patinkin seems to enjoy his Emmy-nominated role on Showtime's Homeland, he deeply regrets his small-screen turn on CBS's Criminal Minds. The crime procedural had Patinkin dealing with grisly, violent subject matter every day, and he didn't like it. The biggest public mistake I ever made was that I chose to do Criminal Minds, said Patinkin. Apparently, dealing with fictional terrorism is a lot more pleasant than dealing with make-believe serial killers. Not to mention that while Homeland has landed the actor 4 Emmy nominations and one Golden Globe, Criminal Minds netted Patinkin exactly 0. Here's an interesting one. Meryl Streep doesn't like the French Lieutenant's woman. Sure, she might be considered the greatest living actor, but when Meryl Streep herself isn't happy with all of her filmed roles, she was displeased with her turn in Roseanne Barr, the Roseanne Barr She-Devil? Nope. Streep's only regret is the French Lieutenant's woman. Streep doesn't disparage the film itself, but thinks she did the part a disservice. She felt disconnected from the character and remains embarrassed by her performance. Apparently, identifying with a reanimated corpse in death becomes her the world's worst mom in August Osage County, the Manchurian candidate, and a literal witch in Into the Woods was a complete cakewalk comparatively. I remember when they asked, they did ask Meryl Streep, I can't remember what show she was on, but they asked her if she has any role that she doesn't like, and the first thing that she said was French Lieutenant's Woman. Which, she got nominated for that, for, like, Best Actress. Well, she gets nominated for everything. So it's just a given that Meryl Streep's going to get an Oscar nomination. And that's just, you know, given. Hey, Nick, did you ever see a movie in the circa 1960s called Dirty Dingus McGee, starring Frank Sinatra? If you did, I was wondering what you thought of his performance in it. He seemed like Ernest T. Bass' character on the Andy Griffith Show. That's Steve. I did see Dirty Dingus McGee. I have to say, I don't remember it, really, because I saw it so many years ago. It doesn't stand out, so I guess it wasn't a very special movie. 773 Acre says Burt Reynolds in The Name of the King was terrible. Oh yeah, that was an awful movie. That was a truly awful movie. Also Jude Law and Alfie. Oy. Bad idea remaking Alfie. I like Jude Law. Good actor, perfectly charming guy. But remaking Alfie, I remember just, you know, thinking why. You've got the definitive version. No one's ever going to top Michael Caine. Bob says, Nick, I'm sure you would disagree with me, but Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels in Dumb and Dumber, I thought that movie was awful. I love that movie. And I think both of their performances are great. Jeff Daniels is one of these guys who's, like, critically acclaimed, does stage work and everything. He is most proud of, in his film work, he's most proud of Dumb and Dumber. Like, if you ask him, what's your favorite role? He's like, Dumb and Dumber. And he said, working with Jim Carrey was amazing. I think that movie's hilarious, man. Hilarious.
It's where I learned to put out the vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. welcome back, Nick, from a texter. Kirk Douglas and Farrah Fawcett and Saturn V. Ugh. Terrible movie. Terrible movie. I remember that the big deal was at that time, because that movie came out like in, I want to say 1980 or 1979, like right at right around the height of Farrah Fawcett's popularity. I think she had already left Charlie's Angels by the time the movie came out. The big deal was, I remember Saturn V, the big deal was that she had a nude scene in it. Farrah Fawcett had a nude scene and everybody was going nuts. You know, because she was the it girl from Charlie's Angels. And, but yeah, I mean, everybody was going nuts over the nude scene. Yeah. Let's see. Area code here says the cable guy with Matthew Broderick and Jim Carrey. Another movie that I liked. Another Jim Carrey movie that I liked. 815 area code. Everything Nick Cage has done recently. Yeah, I can see that. Although Mandy was pretty cool. Mandy was pretty cool. The last crazy horror movie that he made with a chainsaw fight in it. 219 area code says worst movie ever, Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation with Matthew McConaughey. And Renee Zellweger's in that one too. Before they became stars. Let's see. Here is Jay on WGN. Hey, Jay.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, what's up?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, you were talking about the superheroes like Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
And George Clooney as Batman.
Right.
Ben Affleck as Daredevil. Edward Norton played the Hulk in the second of the Hulk movies.
Yeah.
And it was totally uninspired, and he just acted like he would rather be doing something else. And
it's a terrible movie and a terrible performance.
Yeah. I mean, Eric Bana was pretty... I actually thought Eric Bana was good in the first one.
So did I.
And then what's the guy, Ruffalo?
Mark Ruffalo. He's currently Hulk. He's currently the Hulk, yeah.
Yeah, and he's great, but the Edward Norton, I don't know why he even accepted that role, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Thank you, Jay.
All right, thanks a lot for having
me. See ya. All right, here's Adam in Rockford on WGN. Hey, Adam.
What's up, Nick?
Hey.
I guess I thought that when it originally came out, I thought, hey, it's a David Ayer movie. I like Christian Bale, but man, Harsh Times. That movie is really, really close to being unwatchable. And you don't want to feel bad because we've seen or heard, I guess, Christian Bale exploding on people. But man, just Russell Crowe and Christian Bale, these guys that kind of, I don't know who picks their movies for them, but Russell Crowe, especially recently with the Noah movie and stuff like that. But yeah. Man, these guys are just in some stink bomb movies. All right. Thanks, Nick.
All right, Adam. Take care. I don't remember much about Harsh Times. I know it's a David Ayer movie, which means it's about corrupt cops, because those are the movies he makes. That's like his milieu. I don't remember. I know I didn't hate it. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hey, Nick. How you doing, man?
All right. What's up?
I have a great one. Your spiel on Chevy Chase really got me thinking. You had me given kind of a flashback as to a movie that Chevy Chase was in with that would be great for Svengoolie. I mean, because it's so bad. It's like I was like 12 or 13, and it had me thinking like I was stoned or tripping on something, but I obviously wasn't. It is so awful. It's called Under the Rainbow, and it had a lot of the midget actors from The Wizard of Oz in it, and I don't remember much about it, but it was bad.
It's,
and it was bizarre.
Yeah, it was released in 1980, and it was about the little people. From The Wizard of Oz, and it was Chevy Chase, and if I remember correctly, Carrie Fisher.
Was
the female lead, and I remember, I think I laughed once during the entire movie, if I remember correctly.
It was bizarre. That's what made me laugh. I was like, "What is going on with this film?"
Yeah, it's a strange one. Under the Rainbow, absolutely.
That's something I've got. I'm good friends with Rich Coase. Or is it Coz?
It's Coz.
Anyway, I'm going to write him and see if he can find that one, because that is just something for his show.
Okay. All right. Thanks, John.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Yeah. All right. And the final one here, let's end on this note. Sylvester Stallone, Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Stallone's made a lot of bad movies. He's the first to admit that he played pretty bad roles. He has a country singer in Rhinestone comes to mind. But one movie tops his list. That's Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. The curious punctuation in the title alone makes the film difficult, but the script's even worse. Stallone once said, "If you ever want someone to confess to murder, just make him or her sit through that film. They will confess anything after 15 minutes." And you know what? We're going to take Rocky's word on that one. Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Oh, man. A terrible movie. All right, let's break here. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to talk about Easter eggs that you can spot in movies as well. All right, okay. And here's the, you're coming up after the news.
I'm on the top of the world looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is the love that I found ever since you've been around. Your love's put me at the top of the world.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. That, of course, is the Carpenters. Who requested the Carpenters?
That was Dave from Monroe, Wisconsin.
Dave from Monroe, Wisconsin. So we get to hear a couple more Carpenter songs here on this Thursday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. And, so... It's Punchki Day for us, we want to thank again the guys at Central Continental Bakery for you bringing down the Punchkis, and we've got Punchkis galore here. And they're big and crazy and Punchki-like. So we want to thank those guys once again. So all right. Now, you guys know what Easter eggs are in movies. Easter eggs are... these little things that are hidden inside the movie that they don't tell you about, like little tributes to other things. There's a ton of them in other movies, and some of them in some of the movies, and some of them are just really like weird and unexpected. Like, for instance, have you noticed multiple Easter egg references to The Shining in the Toy Story trilogy? Which just seems so weird that this kids' movie, the Toy Story trilogy, the guys who made it clearly like The Shining, because there's a lot of references to The Shining. So be on the lookout for this. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about these Easter eggs that you can find and they're really, really fun to look for. In the world of Toy Story, the toys are living, breathing creatures who have to keep the fact a secret from the humans that care for them. And while eagle-eyed adults may have caught the references to Tim Allen's sitcom Home Improvement, you probably missed multiple Easter egg references to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. The first nod to The Shining appears in the first movie, where the carpet in Sid's house is identical to the carpet in the Overlook Hotel. But the references don't stop there. The number 237 not only pops up multiple times over the trilogy, but it's also Jack's room number at the doomed hotel. So, there you go. How about this one? Pulp Fiction and Captain America Winter Soldier. The Marvel Cinematic Universe is a treasure trove of in-universe Easter eggs with connections to comics, characters who would have yet graced the screen, and small nods to original creators. But Captain America the Winter Soldier links Nick Fury to another Samuel L. Jackson, another character he has portrayed, and that's Jules Winfield. At the end of the movie, when Nick Fury stands in front of his own grave, the headstone has the quote from Ezekiel 25:17. That's the same Bible verse that Jules quotes in Pulp Fiction the night before right before he shoots a man. Are they actually the same person? That's really funny. I didn't even notice that. I've seen Winter Soldier a couple of times. The path of the righteous man, .. That's on the gravestone. I'm looking at the picture of it right now. All right, here's some Easter eggs for you. How about Starbucks in Fight Club? You know the first rule of Fight Club is that you don't talk about Fight Club, and we all know the second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. One of the unwritten rules may be that you should never go anywhere without your Starbucks coffee. If you watch the movie closely, you'll see that David Fincher manages to slip a Starbucks coffee mug in nearly every scene of the movie, which means it's really not that weird that you end up craving a grande mocha every time you pop the movie in. I've never noticed that before, and I've seen Fight Club 9,000 times. Now I have to, that's another excuse to watch Fight Club. So he puts a Starbucks cup in almost every scene. That does make sense, though, considering the theme of the movie. You know, because it's so like sort of anti-corporate, and Starbucks is as ubiquitous and corporate as you can possibly get. That's pretty funny. I never noticed that before. Starbucks in almost every scene of Fight Club. That's crazy. You got to mark these down. How about THX 1138? It's in Swingers. In Doug Liman and Jon Favreau's feature Swingers, two unemployed wannabe actors drift around Los Angeles in search of the swing club scene. The two friends club hop in their cars, and when they pull up to one of the clubs, you read one of the characters' license plates is THXH1138. It turns out that even in the world of Swingers, George Lucas is a big deal. THX 1138, a reference to his first film, is not scattered throughout the film. And those are friends Steven Spielberg, but a dozen other movies find a way to pay homage to the breakout movie. X marks the spot in The Departed. Martin Scorsese's remake of The Departed is a twisted crime tale that tells the story of a showdown between the Boston police and the Irish mob. Both sides plant moles in the opposing organization, and the result is a complete bloodbath by the end of the film. But did you know that all the deaths are foreshadowed? Every single character who dies over the course of the movie appears early with an X in the frame. The only character who doesn't share the screen with an X is Mark Wahlberg, and he's the only character that makes it out alive. Oh, I never noticed that either. So there's X's all over the place. I'm looking at Matt Damon, and he's standing right by a couple of X's. So the X's foreshadowed the deaths of everybody in The Departed. A lot of death in The Departed. Oranges in The Godfather. Now, this one I've noticed. This one I knew. As we saw in the case of The Departed, acclaimed directors can be masters of imagery and foreshadowing. Once you know for what to look like on screen, you'll be amazed at your friends at your ability to predict which character will die. While The Departed's X mark a character for death, The Godfather trilogy, Francis Ford Coppola uses oranges to show that a character is due to meet an untimely end. Whether it's a fun fruit bowl or simply a peel in a cocktail, the character holding the orange won't be around much longer. And that's how Vito dies. And he's playing with his grandson, and he's got an orange in his mouth. He's got the orange peel in his mouth. But yeah, I remember noticing the oranges years ago. Star Wars and Indiana Jones: Raiders of the Lost Ark. As an archaeologist, the main character in Indiana Jones spends a lot of time crawling around in tombs, investigating ruins, and retrieving lost artifacts. He's constantly deciphering hieroglyphics, translating ancient runes, and puzzling out cryptic messages. But there's one picto puzzle that may be easier for viewers to solve than Indy. It turns out that the Star Trek movies weren't around at the time when droids from Star Wars could be found outside of the original universe. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, R2-D2 isn't alone, but can be found alongside C-3PO and Princess Leia in two different sets of hieroglyphics. Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty common one. You know, considering George Lucas produced Raiders, and he and Spielberg are friends, that was clearly an inside joke. But that one's been noted many times. That's kind of an infamous Easter egg. So, all right. Let's take a quick break. We've got more secrets and Easter eggs to point out. And if you guys remember any of them, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We got a break here for some weather. Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, mostly cloudy, chilly, highs in the upper 20s, and afternoon flurries are possible. Tomorrow, mixed clouds and sun, highs in the mid-30s. Saturday, mostly cloudy, breezy, high of 32. A few flurries could fall early. For Sunday, cloudy, chance of snow, then clearing, high in the mid-teens. And Monday, mostly sunny and a high in the single digits. Currently 12 degrees at O'Hare. It's 15 at Midway, 17 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break here. When we come back, more cool Easter eggs for you to spot while you're watching some movies. And if you want to jump in with talk or text, it's 312-981-7200.
We've only begun.
Welcome back, everybody. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18th floor above downtown Chicago. Here till 5 o'clock. That, of course, was the Carpenters. And it's Triple Play Thursday. Hey, coming up, we're going to play back a very exciting Blackhawks Express from last night's game. It was a late game, in fact. So we'll play that a little bit later on in the show here. But right now we're talking about these fun Easter eggs that you can spot in movies, some of which I didn't know. Actually, many of which I didn't know. So this next one is another kind of a crazy adult Easter egg to throw into a kid's movie. We've already talked about the multiple references to The Shining that you can spot in the Toy Story movies. In the movie Rango, you can spot a Fear and Loathing reference. In the animated movie Rango, Johnny Depp plays a chameleon who finds himself in the small outpost town of Dirt, a place that's in rather desperate need of a new sheriff. It's a fun, family-friendly movie that ends up sharing a connection with another Depp movie that's far less appropriate for school-age kids. At one point in the film, Rango ends up flying through the air and lands smack on the windshield of a convertible. But it's not just a convertible. Both the car and the passengers that Rango stumble upon strongly resemble those from Depp's earlier movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And I did remember that from Rango. Absolutely. I didn't like Rango. I'm one of the few people that didn't like that movie. Everybody pretty much loves that movie, but I'm not a big fan. But I do remember really loving that movie, or that reference. R2-D2 is in Star Trek Into Darkness. Star Trek exists in our galaxy in the far future, while Star Wars happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Yet, that doesn't stop a certain friendly droid from making an appearance in J.J. Abrams' both Star Trek and its sequel, Star Trek Into Darkness. It's no secret that J.J. Abrams is a huge fan of Star Wars, but you probably weren't expecting to see R2-D2 pop up in a different franchise. However, this is one that you blink and you can miss it cameo. It's only spotted by eagle-eyed viewers in the debris. And they've got a picture of it here, and I can't see them. I don't spot R2-D2. Not a lot of people watch Star Trek Into Darkness very closely. So that, you know what I mean? Because it's not a very good movie. Let's see. Linda Blair in Scream. In the 90s, Scream set out to revitalize the horror movie franchise, which had started to grow a bit stale. Wes Craven found success and a fan base through successfully satirizing and subverting the standard horror movie cliches while paying homage to the movies that paved the way. One way Scream paid homage, an uncredited cameo goes to Linda Blair of Exorcist fame, who made an appearance in the film as a reporter that amuses Sydney outside of the school. This deliberate move, including one of the queens of horror, proved that Scream wasn't out to destroy the memory of the movies that came before it. You know, there are a ton of Easter eggs in the Scream movies. You know, in the first scene when Drew Barrymore is, you know, on the phone, and, you know, there are several, like, sort of, like, music cues that are from different movies. You know, you can hear the music cue from, like, the Exorcist. There's a music cue from Nightmare on Elm Street, which, of course, Wes Craven directed. And there's also the line that Drew Barrymore has. Before the guy turns out to be the killer, when he's just asking her if she likes horror movies and stuff, do you like scary movies? He says something to the effect of, "What about the Nightmare on Elm Street movies? What about the Freddy Krueger movies?" And she goes, "Ah, only the first one's good. It's because Wes Craven only directed the first one." And then she said, "Only the first one's good. The rest of them stink." But no, I mean, Scream is loaded with those kind of references and tributes. I mean, it really is. That's part of the fun of the movie. There's so many Easter eggs in that one. So, let's see. Here is Trucker D on WGN. Hey, D.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Back to The Godfather. I think it's the original one where Luca gets killed. Do you remember that?
Sure.
And Sleep with the Fishes
right.
and all that.
Right.
Well, when he walks into the bar, there's a door. He walks into the bar, and there's like a little window plating around him. And the window plating is sketched with, you know, into the glass fishes. And every time I noticed it the second time, but every time, well, I've seen The Godfather like 20 times.
Yeah.
But every time I see that, it's so eerie because he kind of stands there for a second and fixes himself. And he looks like he's at the bottom of the ocean with fishes.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I have to go back.
You see it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to go anyway, back and look for it.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool scene.
All right, man, take care.
You got it.
Take care. Yeah. That's pretty cool. How about The Lion King and Hercules? Despite taking place in the ancient Greece, the modern Disney classic Hercules didn't distance itself from the movies that took place in the future. There's a lot of proof that most Disney movies take place in a single universe, but this Easter egg may prove that they've also discovered time travel. After finding fame as a hero who protected cities, saved children, and rescued damsels, Hercules was posing for a sculpture. If you look close enough, you'll see that he's wearing the fur he's wearing over his shoulders is none other than the scar from The Lion King. Oh, I'm looking at the picture right now. It is. That's pretty crazy. Wow, that's pretty crazy. You got to be pretty sharp to check that out. Let's see. Star Wars and E.T. It's been well established that Spielberg and Lucas are good friends. This was the first movie where the characters crossed over. When E.T. was released in theaters, it was a pleasant surprise to see some familiar characters from the Star Wars universe show up in the movie. Yoda is the first character to show up in the form of a Halloween costume, while Elliot and E.T. are out trick-or-treating, with the added bonus of Yoda's theme being heard during the encounter. But even more Star Wars characters can be seen scattered throughout the toys in Elliot's room. I remember the Yoda costume. There's a lot of references to that. Pulp Fiction in From Dusk Till Dawn. It's no secret that Quentin Tarantino's movies are connected in some weird, obscure way. The real challenge is trying to figure out connections that overlap between his films when they appear to visit in completely different universes. Take the Tarantino-penned From Dusk Till Dawn, where vampires exist, people still need their burger fixed. The characters in Dusk make a pit stop at a popular Hawaiian burger joint called the Big Kahuna Burger to fuel up. This just happens to be the same burger place that Brett gets a burger from before Jules and Vincent drop by in his place in Pulp Fiction. There's a ton of references to... I mean, it's another... That's another universe. The Quentin Tarantino movies... They're loaded with references to his other movies. Like the cigarettes that people smoke in Quentin Tarantino's movies are fictional. They're called Red Apples. And they don't exist in real life. So that's a made-up Tarantino brand for cigarettes that is used in all his movies. There's a bunch of connections between his movies too. You got to be pretty sharp to catch them all. But yeah, there's references all over the place in those movies. More Easter eggs here. Original cast cameos in Mary Poppins Returns. Mary Poppins first graced our screen in 1965 when she floated down to become the nanny for the Banks children, Jane and Michael. After more than 40 years, she's finally making her triumphant comeback in Mary Poppins Returns. But it turns out she's not the only one who's popping up. Karen Detrice, the original Jane, can be spotted on the street when Jack the Lamplighter is talking to Emily Mortimer, her version of Jane. And she stops to ask for directions. When she says thank you, she signs off by saying, many thanks, sincerely, a nod to one of the film's original songs. And also Dick Van Dyke's in it, too. Let's see. The Twin Pines Mall and Back to the Future. One of the lessons from Robert Zemeckis' popular Back to the Future trilogy is that any actions of the past have a direct impact on the future. Doc cautions Marty against making any changes, as anything he could, anything he does could end up wiping himself out of existence. Even as careful as he tries to be, Marty's careless driving takes out a pine tree towards the beginning of the movie. This may not seem like much, but it ends up changing the future in some small way. In the original 1985 mall, Marty hangs out at is called Twin Pines Mall. After his reckless driving ruins the tree from the past, he returns to the future, and the same mall is now called Lone Pine Mall. Yeah, I knew that one because I've seen Back to the Future 4,000 times, approximately. Okay. Why don't we take a break? And we got more fun Easter eggs to tell you about. And if you remember any sort of really cool ones from movies, 312-981-7200. That's the phone number. And we've got more coming up after the news, which is next.
Long ago, and oh so far away, I fell in love with you. For the second show, your guitar,
yeah,
sounds so sweet.
So, first thing I think of is Tommy Boy when I hear this song. One of the funniest moments in that entire movie. That's another movie that, if Tommy Boy were on a 24-hour loop, I would watch it. movie is hilarious. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Blackhawks Express coming up in just a few minutes. But right now we're talking about these great fun Easter eggs that you can find in other movies, like little tributes to other movies and things like that. And so we've been talking about a bunch of those. So keep your eyes peeled, and hopefully you guys will remember a few of these. Next time you watch these movies, you can spot some of the cool stuff that we've been talking about. And filmmakers obviously do that on purpose and as a tribute to other movies that they love or other filmmakers that they know. So it's kind of fun to spot them. Here's Ron on WGN. Hi, Ron.
Hey.
Hey.
So you mentioned Star Wars in E.T., but... you know, Lucas returned the favor, and I think it was in The Phantom Menace, but it was in one of the prequel movies that the E.T. characters are in one of the pods.
Yeah. That is Phantom Menace. That is Phantom Menace. It's the Senate scene. It's where they're in the Senate. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I totally remember that.
I remember that kind of off to the right, and I was like, holy cow, there they are.
Yeah, okay. All right, cool. Thanks, Ron.
Yep.
Yeah, the ET planets, they're part of the Senate during the meeting where Jar Jar Binks screws everything up. Well, he almost screws up the whole movie. Well, he does, basically. So, here's one of my favorites. This is truly one of my favorites. Animal House is in Twilight Zone, the movie. John Landis directed Animal House. He also directed one of the... four shorts stories in Twilight Zone, the movie. And it says here, when you think about the Twilight Zone, toga and beer parties are not the first thing that come to mind. But in the movie adaptation of the series, and Animal House may be more connected than you realize in one story, we briefly meet an American soldier in Vietnam who laments to his squad, "We never should have shot Lieutenant Niedermeyer." Doug Niedermeyer also happens to be the name of the main antagonist in Animal House. The movie's final scene in the overlaid text informs of each character's future. Niedermeyer happens to read that he went on to Vietnam where he was shot by his own men. So Landis brings that back in Twilight Zone, which I just thought was hilarious. You know, just really funny. We shouldn't have shot Lieutenant Niedermeyer. All right, we got more here. Brian is on WGN. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Brother Nick.
Hey.
One of the ones from the Superman from the first one, they showed a train going, and there was an old lady and a little girl on there, and the little girl sees Superman running really fast next to the train.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the old lady is the Lois Lane from the Black and White series.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a surprise cameo then.
Yep, that's right. And there's one more from one of the first Star Wars prequels. If you look in there, show one of the ships landing, you can see the Millennium Falcon landing also.
Oh, right. I remember that, too. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
Reference to the Millennium Falcon. That's right.
Yeah, that was good.
Cool. All right, Brian. Thanks, man.
Hey, sure, man.
All right. Yeah. That's funny. Mickey Mouse is in Tron. Getting trapped in a computer mainframe may seem like a programmer's worst nightmare, but it's Kevin Flynn's reality in Tron. Caught inside his software, he has to interact with the program, manipulating it in ways that benefit him and aid in his escape. Along the way, he runs into a few friendly faces. Tron is a Disney property, so it's not exactly a surprise that one of the infamous hidden Mickey's appearances in the grid. When the solar sailor is flying over various terrains. But you may be surprised that both Pac-Man and King Kong also make an appearance. I'm not a big fan of Tron, so I have not really watched it, but I'm looking at a picture and there it is. There's Pac-Man right there, right on the grid that David Warner is staring at. So lots of these things. All right, let's see. Here is Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
Yeah. In Pulp Fiction, Chris Walken's speech about the travails of the watch.
Yeah.
He uses character, well, the whole story from Howard Hawks Air Force, where the Harry Carey Sr. character, passes on the watch, you know, it's basically a call out to the Howard Hawks film Air Force,
yeah.
The whole watch deal.
Wow, okay. Yeah, that's really one of my favorite monologues that Tarantino's ever written.
Right.
And it is really, really funny.
It's funny, yeah. I say, hey, man, he's talking about Howard Hawks Air Force.
Right, that's pretty cool. Of course, you know, the movie geek that Tarantino is, of course, that was on purpose, no question about
right.
it. So...
Right. Yeah, because he uses the character's name also. He's
yeah.
the same character, right?
That's very cool. Okay, thanks, Mike.
All right, Nick, take it easy.
Have a good one, man. Yeah, Tarantino, man, he does that kind of stuff all the time. He'll load up his movies with references to other movies and tributes and things like that. Yeah, you keep your eyes peeled when you're watching a Tarantino movie because he's such a movie geek that he will throw in all kinds of references and all kinds of things. How about this one? Lethal Weapon in Maverick. In Maverick, a comedic Western based on the popular late 50s, early 60s TV show, Mel Gibson is Brett Maverick, a card player and con man who is trying to buy his way into a high-stakes poker game. The bank robbing escapade. Oh, I'm going to sneeze. Whew. All right. Thank you. Bank robbing escapade reunites Gibson with an old acquaintance, the bank robbing old friend, is none other than Danny Glover, his partner from Lethal Weapon. In their brief interaction, Maverick swears he knows him, but he can't remember how. And don't worry, Glover is still too old for this stuff. Not to mention the star of Maverick TV show, James Garner, plays Gibson's father in the movie. I remember when I saw Maverick, people actually kind of went nuts when that happened. Like when Danny Glover showed up, people went nuts. Not me, but other people. Star Wars in Hook. Oh, Hook, what a terrible movie. Hook is full of magical moments, exciting adventures, and even a little pixie dust. But did you know that George Lucas and Carrie Fisher make a brief cameo in the Peter Pan adaptation? The two can be spotted briefly as a couple kissing on the bridge in the film's opening It's not Han and Leia, but a truly underrated Star Wars Easter egg. Steven Spielberg and George Lucas have been friends since they were film students in California, so it's no surprise that the friends pop up in each other's films. But did Carrie Fisher? How did Carrie Fisher sneak in? Turns out she did some uncredited script doctoring for the film. Okay. Speaking of Steven Spielberg and Carrie Fisher, Spielberg shows up in the Blues Brothers at the end. He's in the office where they want to, where they have to pay to keep the school and the church alive. That's him. That's Spielberg. That's Steven Spielberg. Carrie Fisher's obviously in that movie too. Jaws and Mallrats. Kevin Smith interconnected movie universe is so chock full of Easter eggs that it can be difficult to narrow it down. There's another guy. Yeah, that's right. Kevin Smith and Quentin Tarantino, they load their movies with cross references and Easter eggs constantly. They have their own little universes. You know, they create, like, Kevin Smith creates this whole universe where all these characters from his different movies exist. Let's see. And Mallrats is certainly no exception. However, many fans miss the film's homage to one of Kevin's all-time favorite movies, Jaws. The two main characters in Mallrats are named T.S. Quint and Brody. Is that right?
That is right.
Wow. I never knew that. I've only seen Mallrats a few times.
It's one of my favorite. That is a movie that we talked about the other day that if it's on, it's a remote dropper for me.
I didn't know that Quint and Brody?
Yeah.
Is there a Hooper in the movie?
No.
Oh, man, there should be a Hooper.
That would be
great. And while they may be spelled differently, there's no mistaking that these two slackers share names with the lead characters in Spielberg's epic shark thriller. And, not to leave Hooper out, his namesake makes an appearance in another Smith movie, Chasing Amy.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. That's pretty cool. I never noticed that before.
Yeah, Smith is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's one of the ones that I could watch his films over and over.
Yeah. I like, you know, he's made some clinkers, but...
But
I, you know, they mentioned Chasing Amy. Chasing Amy is my favorite Kevin Smith movie. I think that's the best movie he's ever made. I know a lot of people hated Clerks 2, but I loved Clerks 2.
I liked it.
I thought it was great. Yeah. It was really great. How about this? Nike in A Knight's Tale. Oh, I remember this. A Knight's Tale is a fun medieval romp that not only rife with anachronism, it practically embraces them. The story is loosely inspired by the Canterbury Tales. Not only blends period setting with modern rock anthems and sayings that you wouldn't find very familiar on appearance. When William needs new amour to Jocelyn, he turns to the talented female blacksmith who has designed her own lightweight gear. And so everyone knows who just forged it. She signs it by engraving a Nike swoosh on the chest. Just Do It can apply to jousting as easily as basketball. And I don't remember that. I don't remember that at all.
I do. I remember that.
Yeah. The ETs in Phantom Menace, we just mentioned before. Batman is in Watchmen. Zack Snyder brought the dense, expansive world of Watchmen to the silver screen in 2009 with so much source material to work with. It's amazing he found room to include some other DC world Easter eggs. But if you can find them, you'll know where to look. The best cameo appears in the opening credits when the original Night Owl punches a guy who suspiciously resembles Joe Chill. Yes, the same man who murdered Bruce Wayne's parents and set him onto the path of becoming Batman. In fact, Mr. and Mrs. Wayne can be seen off to the side right next to a sign that says Gotham. All right. We have to break here. We've got some weather, and then we've got a Blackhawks Express, and then we'll wrap up the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We got a forecast right here from your WGN Weather Center. Today, mostly cloudy and chilly, highs in the upper 20s. Afternoon flurries possible. For tomorrow, mixed sun or cloud mixed with sun, highs in the mid-30s. Saturday, mostly cloudy, breezy, high of 32. A few flurries could fall early. For Sunday, cloudy chance of snow, then clearing, high in the mid-teens. And then for Monday, mostly sunny and single-digit highs. Currently 12 degrees at O'Hare, 15 at Midway, 17 degrees at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break, and the Blackhawks Express will be coming up right after this. Chicago!
Chicago Blackhawks close out the month of February out on the left coast in a must-win battle with Anaheim, who now has a new bench boss. Former Hawks D-man Bob Murray is now the GM and head coach, and he's been told to fix the Ducks. So with the trade deadline now a memory, the Hawks need to win games and not be part of any Duck solution. The opening faceoff between Jonathan Taves and the centerman for the Anaheim Ducks, Devin Shore, who was recently acquired from Dallas. Taves wins the draw. We're underway as the Hawks gain the Duck zone. The boards to Rowney, spins it behind the net. Richie put it out in front. Rowney with a shot, big save by Crawford. And then another shot there by Richie from the side of the net. And Crawford smothers it down to the ice beside the net and holds on. And a whistle stops play. Fed it down to the left wing corner. Jones is there for Anaheim. Rolls into the left circle. Jones from the slot with a backhand. Turned wide with a stick save. Rebound and Jones with a shot from between the circles. Crawford down with a butterfly save. His best save of the night. Here's DeBrincat, top of the left circle. Pulls it in. Shoots. He scores! The Cat! 13 seconds into the Citgo Fueling Good power play. And it's 1-0 Hawks. Send it up the right wing side at center ice. Look out, here come the Ducks. Brownie actually now down the far side. A shot, they score! It's Devin Shore moving down the right wing side. He tried to use Grant in the left circle as a decoy. And Shore fired the puck. It actually deflected past Crawford into the Hawk net. It's a shorthanded goal. The Ducks have tied the score at 1. Battling there, lost the puck, and here come the Ducks, 3-on-1. Look down, Henrik through center ice, over the Hawk line, down the right wing, put it across, Perry left circle, he shoots, and Crawford is down with a butterfly save. And he'll hold the puck, and a whistle will stop play. The other way, Anisimov through center ice, crossing the Duck line, down the left wing, to the net, shoots, he scores! Artem Anisimov rips one into the top shelf, it's a shorthanded goal! And the Hawks reassume the lead at 2-1. Seabrook in the near corner. Hit by Richie. Clears the puck away. Not out. And Kessler fires from the top of the left circle. They score. Carter Rowney may have tipped this one on the way to the Hawk net. But it eludes Corey Crawford. And with 1:23 left in period number 2, we're tied at 2. Here's Manson from the Duck zone. Passing up ice for Derek Grant. The pass misses. Slides all the way down. But Grant was the first one of the dots. Got the puck in front. Shot from Terry, they score.
Well, there's your ugly goal.
Grant from behind the Hawk net, flipped it up the slot. Troy Terry rifles it past Crawford. That's his second goal on the season, and the Ducks now lead 3-2. Outlet pass to DeBrincat at center ice, crossing the Duck line, gave it a tase down the left wing. Carries behind the net, and center, he scores! This is DeBrincat, his second goal of the game. What a brilliant play by Tays. He looped in behind the Duck net. He got Miller moving to the left post, thinking it was going to be a wraparound. And then Taves fed it to the bottom of the left wing circle. There was DeBrincat to pound it home, and we're tied at 3. Slater Cuckoo, who wins the battle, got it to Taves. Assad breaks it over the Duck line to Kane. Now the slot, he says he scores! Patrick Kane scores for the Hawks with 16 seconds left in regulation. A perfect feed from the left wing boards from Saad. Right on the money on Kane's stick in the slot. And he snapped it into the top shelf. And the Hawks lead 4-3. Into the Hawk zone, far corner. Jones pushed off the puck. Seabrook fires it to center ice. 3 seconds, 2-1. And the Hawks have won here in Anaheim. An enormous victory for the Blackhawks. They came in here to Anaheim and they needed a win and they got it. It took them all the way to late in the third period for them to forge ahead and finally decide this one. But Patrick Kane with his 40th goal on the season from Saad, and Slater Cuckoo at 1944 has seen to that.
Yeah, there it is, man. couldn't have ended in more dramatic fashion, I'm telling you. And Kaner, what a year. What a season he's having. It's nuts.
Yeah, 40 goals.
It's nuts.
40 goals. Man.
Man, oh man, oh man. So that was an exciting game. What's the next? Next one's a matinee, right? It's like Saturday at 2 or something like that? Or am I nuts?
Yeah. Yes.
Saturday?
Yeah, against Los Angeles.
Yeah, there you go. Because they're still on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Tune into that.
I can't remember because they play Sunday night as well.
So they play Saturday afternoon, Sunday night. Where are they? In Vegas on Sunday night? Or?
You know what? I don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll figure it out.
So many things between then and now.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we've been talking about cool little Easter eggs that you can find in movies. Like, for instance, you can see Tangled in the movie Frozen. The wonderful world of Disney is vast, expansive, and connected. Some of the connections are small, like the carpet from Aladdin showing up in Beauty and the Beast, or Scar being used as a rug in Hercules. However, there's a lot of evidence that points Frozen being close to the center of this complicated web. Specifically, there's one connection to another Disney film that's right out there in the open. When the castle gates open for the first time prior to Elsa's coronation, you see Rapunzel in Tangled among the first guests to make their way inside. So there you go. Oh, by the way, Mary Sandberg just sent me a text. It's they're playing San Jose on Sunday. So thank you, Mary.
I gave her that one.
Oh.
I realized it after I said, I don't know.
Well, now we know for sure. Let's see. More little quick little cameos. Marvel history in X-Men. Well, there's a cameo in all the Marvel movies. I mean, just the fact that Stan Lee is in, like, all of them. It's always fun to spot Stan Lee.
Oh, my gosh. The characters he is.
You know what my favorite Stan Lee cameo?
Which one?
Is in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. He shows a little animated Stan Lee shows up.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. The whole audience, when we saw the movie, the whole audience went, aw, you know. Did he? I wonder if he filmed a cameo for the Avengers, for the new Avengers movie. If he passed away before he got to film the cameo.
I don't remember. Because I don't remember if Ant-Man and Wasp was the last one.
He was in Ant-Man and Wasp.
Yeah, but I can't remember
whether that was he made the last one that he filmed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll find out. The X-Men has a long history of comics, movies, and even an animated TV show before they were adapted into a live-action movie in 2000. This long history meant that there were a lot of people with ties to the X-Men franchise that wanted to make an appearance in the film. Outside of the now traditional Stan Lee cameo, the actor who voiced Beast in the 1990s cartoon makes an appearance as a truck driver who Rogue hitches a ride with at the very beginning of the movie. And, of course, there's a reference Cyclops makes to the original yellow and blue classic uniforms that had us all giggling. So, and there's a Wizard of Oz reference in Twister, which makes sense because Twister's about tornadoes. I love that movie, by the way. I unapologetically love Twister.
Me too.
I love it.
That's another remote dropper.
Okay, here's a little trivia question for you. What movie's playing at the drive-in before the tornado comes and rips apart the drive-in?
The Shining.
That's right. Nice job, man. Very good. So there's the first nod to Wizard of Oz is when we see a flashback to a childhood memory of Helen Hunt's character. She had a terrier puppy, the same as Dorothy's dog Toto. The second nod later in the movie, right before the tornado touches down and crashes into Aunt Meg's house, she has a Judy Garland film playing on the television. So look for those Easter eggs the next time you watch some of these other movies. All right. We'll be back tomorrow, and it'll be all the regular Friday features. Dan, have a great trip to New York. Enjoy yourself, and we'll see you when you get back. You'll be back for Monday morning show, right?
I think Tuesday.
Tuesday, okay.
I believe Tuesday.
Okay.
I'll be back, and I'll be the rest of the week that week.
All right, well, have a good trip. We'll take a quick break here. The news is up next. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow for all the Friday features and a lot of fun topics as well.